an eating disorder was actually like social media.
About the Girls with me, Catherine Carr, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. This Monday to Friday lunchtime at 1:45.
On FM, on BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker. This is BBC Radio 4.
It's 6 o'clock on Wednesday, the 15th of April. Good morning. This is Today with Nick Robinson and Justin Webb.
Good morning. The headlines this morning. The Chancellor has criticised President Trump's decision to attack Iran without a clear exit plan as she prepares to hold a series of meetings in Washington to discuss the growing economic crisis. We'll hear from business leaders and a Treasury minister about the impact here. A BBC investigation has found that some legal advisers are charging thousands of pounds to help migrants stay in the country by pretending to be gay.
Also in today's programme, cancel culture on American university campuses. We talked to the Emmy Award-winning filmmaker whose documentary on the subject is out today.
I'm not talking about hate speech. I'm not talking about free speech in the kind of First Amendment American way. I'm talking about our ability to speak freely about ideas and issues without fear of cancellation.
We'll find out what 50 years of counting butterflies can tell us about the state of the British countryside. And are Lancastrians losing their regional burr? Not according to the House of Commons Speaker Lindsay Hoyle.
I'm told that I'm the first ever Lancastrian speaker, so we're going to make the most of this. That's what it's all about. It's about Lancashire, making the voice of Lancashire here in London.
The actor Jane Horrocks will join us before nine. The BBC News read this morning by Alan Smith.
The Chancellor Rachel Reeves will hold talks with the US Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent in Washington today after saying she's very frustrated and angry that the US went to war with Iran without an exit plan. In an interview with the Daily Mirror, Ms. Reeves criticised what she called the folly of President Trump's decision. Yesterday, the International Monetary Fund predicted the economic fallout from the conflict would hit the UK harder than any other advanced economy. From the IMF's meeting in Washington, here's our economics editor Faisal Islam.
Among the world's finance ministers and central bankers gathered here at the IMF, there is concern that another geopolitical crisis has hampered economic recovery and threatened household living standards. The Chancellor's public frustration and anger at the economic impact of the war might be tested at her bilateral meeting with her US counterpart, Scott Bessent, later today. He told the BBC yesterday the current disruptions were worth it to avoid the economic impact of a nuclear strike on London. On Friday, the UK and France will host an international conference on reopening the Strait of Hormuz, though only after a peace deal is agreed. Market oil prices had dipped yesterday on the hope of further peace talks, but the concern now is about the physical supplies of gas, diesel, fertiliser products and helium that were due to have been delivered around now, but are still trapped in the Gulf.
The US Vice President J.D. Vance has said that Iran's negotiators want to make a deal, but mistrust between the nations cannot be solved overnight. He was speaking after President Trump suggested that talks with Iran could resume over the next days after they collapsed on Sunday, with the Strait of Hormuz and Tehran's nuclear ambitions among the sticking points. Mr. Vance made the comments at a gathering of the conservative student network Turning Point USA in Georgia.
Honestly, after 49 years, there's a lot of course, mistrust between Iran and the United States of America. You're not going to solve that problem overnight. But yeah, I think the people we're sitting across from wanted to make a deal. And I know the President of the United States told us to go out there and negotiate in good faith. That's what we did. That's what we're going to keep on doing.
A BBC investigation has revealed a shadow industry of legal advisers charging thousands of pounds to help migrants pretend to be gay in order to stay in the country. Those whose visas are due to run out are being given fake cover stories for their asylum claims and are instructed in how to obtain fabricated evidence, including supporting letters and photos at LGBT events. Our politics investigations correspondent Billy Kemba reports.
The UK's asylum process offers protection to people who can't return to their home countries because they would be in danger. But our investigation reveals how some advisers are extracting fees from international students and workers who want to stay in the country. One adviser, Tanisha Khan, told a BBC undercover reporter his only hope was to claim asylum by pretending to be gay. She told the reporter to go to an East London event for gay asylum seekers to help with his application. We secretly filmed a succession of men there, saying many attending weren't genuinely gay. Tanisha Khan denied all wrongdoing and said there'd been communication difficulties because she wasn't a fluent Urdu speaker. The Home Office said anyone found trying to exploit the system would face the full force of the law.
Aid donors, including the UK, are meeting in Berlin on the third anniversary of Sudan's civil war to discuss how to mobilise aid and revive peace talks. A power struggle between the army and the paramilitary group Rapid Support Forces has effectively partitioned Sudan and led to the world's largest humanitarian crisis. Here's our Africa correspondent, Barbara Plet-Usher.
3 years ago today, battles broke out in Khartoum. The capital was the epicenter of this vicious civil war until the army recaptured it from paramilitary RSF fighters. Now, the city is relatively calm, but conflict continues in the west and south of the country, and conditions there are catastrophic. Pockets of famine, with millions of people surviving on just one meal a day. Sudan's economy has collapsed. 65% of the population is in need of food, water, shelter, and medicine. Nearly 12 million people have been forcibly displaced. Peace efforts led by the Americans have failed, as both warring parties get support from regional powers that enables them to keep fighting.
A women's health strategy for England is being unveiled today, including a new scheme branded a patient power payment. Women will be able to give feedback about their treatment, which could lead to money being allocated to areas that need improvement. The strategy, first published by the Conservative government in 2022, has now been updated by Labour. Our health editor Hugh Pym reports.
The latest version of the plan comes against a backdrop of criticism that women's voices are often ignored and marginalised by the NHS. Gynaecology has been selected for the first trial of a scheme which will allocate funding to areas identified as inadequate by patients. A new standard of care will be introduced to ensure women are offered appropriate pain relief for invasive gynaecological procedures. BBC analysis shows that there was a 98% increase in this waiting list over the last 6 years, compared with 58% for other conditions. The Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists has welcomed the strategy, but says that despite the government's commitments on waiting lists, the picture for women remains deeply concerning.
Work is beginning on a six-month operation to clear thousands of tonnes of waste illegally dumped along a field at Kidlington in Oxfordshire. It'll cost £7.3 million to remove the rubbish at the site, which is the first of four areas earmarked for clearance at the taxpayers' expense. Research suggests that many of the UK's butterfly species are facing steep declines because of climate change, habitat loss and pollution. Data from the UK Butterfly Monitoring Scheme suggests that while warmer weather has helped some native species to flourish, many of our most distinctive varieties are struggling to survive.
Thank you. That's 7 minutes past six is the time. Let us turn to our first look at the weather. It comes from Thomas Schaffernacker at the BBC Weather Centre this morning. Morning, Thomas.
Very good morning to you, Justin, and to you listening in. The forecast is mixed for the rest of the week. April showers are certainly on the cards, and this morning most of us will catch some rain at least at some point or another. This morning, across Scotland, Northern Ireland and some western parts of the UK, it is rather damp. It's fairly mild, though. Temperatures are hovering around 10 Celsius. The further east you are, it's a little bit drier here, but the rain will reach you. So I think in northern and western parts of the UK today, expect rain, certainly by around about lunchtime if it doesn't reach you through the morning. But the good news is that if you want some dry weather, it should be coming your way come the afternoon. So western parts of the country come the afternoon should have some sunny spells. However, showers will never be too far away. It's also going to be quite breezy. Now, elsewhere, further east across the country, the afternoon, both the morning and the afternoon, is looking cloudy, but the rain won't reach you until later on. So I think it could be quite heavy by around 3 o'clock, say, around parts of Yorkshire, Lincolnshire, East Anglia and the southeast. Now, here too, it's not particularly cold this morning. And wherever you are today, it's not going to be particularly cold. Highs of around about 15 to 18 Celsius, just the very far north of Scotland, hovering around 10 Celsius. Tonight, there'll be some showers. And then tomorrow, it looks as though we're going to be doing it all over again. Another weather front sweeps in and brings a spell of rain, but I think it won't be quite as heavy. Back to you.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. 9 minutes past six now. Let's take our first look at the morning papers. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, tells The Mirror in her interview with the paper that the war with Iran is a folly, affecting families in the US, the UK and around the world. The Guardian says Ms Reeves' comments were sparked by the IMF's forecast that out of the wealthier G7 nations, Britain will be hit the hardest by the economic fallout. For the I paper, the impact of what it calls Trumpflation is becoming clear for the UK. But on Wall Street, banks have smashed records with their first quarter earnings, according to the Financial Times, as traders benefit from the volatility in global markets.
Daily Mail endorses the criticism from the Labour peer and former NATO chief Lord Robertson that Britain cannot defend itself with higher welfare spending. The Daily Telegraph describes the intervention as one of the most serious rebukes of Sir Keir Starmer to date by a Labour politician.
The Times also focuses on defence, reporting that the Chancellor has proposed increasing defence spending by less than £10 billion over the next 4 years. She said to put forward the figure in discussions with the Prime Minister amid pressure, the paper says, for a bigger increase from the Defence Secretary John Healey. In response, a government spokesperson tells the Times the defence investment plan on future spending will be published as soon as possible.
The Sun leads on changes to the format of the National Lottery, asking who wants to be a billionaire. UK players apparently going to be competing with their US counterparts for the Powerball jackpot, the paper says. The winning odds are 1 in 292 million.
The Women and Equalities Minister, Bridget Phillipson, has, according to the Times, told the equality regulator it must tone down its guidance on single-sex spaces before it can be presented to Parliament. A source tells the paper it was felt the approach had been to exclude transgender people instead of finding ways of being inclusive under the law. Other sources close to Ms. Phillipson dispute the claim and say they requested clarity and for the code to be accessible and robust.
6:10 is the time.
A shadow industry of legal advisers is charging migrants thousands of pounds to pretend they're gay in order to stay in the country. That's the finding of a BBC investigation. Our politics investigations correspondent Billy Kemba joins us now. Tell us how this scheme works, Billy.
Good morning. So our investigation has revealed how legal advisers are extracting fees from international students, those on work and tourist visas who want to stay in the country. And the more we looked into this, the more taken aback we were by just how sophisticated these efforts were. It's not just people trying to get a fake claim through the Home Office on a whim. The advisers involved have thought about and planned every stage of the process. And that begins with creating fake evidence. They tell people, for example, to go to gay clubs multiple times, to take photographs while they're there, to take photographs of their drinks receipts, potentially to go to GPs and pretend to be depressed to get a prescription from them, again, as more records they can submit to the Home Office. They even have people willing to sign a statement pretending to say, pretending to have been someone's partner, to say that they've had a sexual relationship with the claimant. And so the level of sophistication to this, to building up a whole patchwork of evidence, is quite something. And then when they get to the stage of having an interview with the Home Office, when you apply for asylum, you have an interview to scrutinise your claims. There's coaching, there's a questionnaire put together of questions that other fake applicants have had recently, all of it geared to trying to dupe the Home Office into allowing people to stay in the country who otherwise wouldn't have the right to do so.
Yeah, on the grounds that they would be unsafe if they were returned home. Have we got any idea of the scale of this?
We can see from the investigation that there are systematic attempts to cheat the immigration system in this way. There's a whole infrastructure in place to do it. Doesn't, of course, mean that there aren't many genuine asylum claims, and that's what asylum is there to provide. It's to offer protection to those who potentially fear for their lives if they were had to live in their home countries. The truth is, it's hard to give exact numbers on this. The problem is that this is obviously a hidden industry, and the Home Office hasn't published any statistics on the number of asylum claims in total for people applying on the basis of sexual orientation for a few years now. So we need investigations like this to try and give a sense of the scale of it.
Billy Kemba, thank you.
6:13, the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has gone to China and announced in the past couple of hours that Vladimir Putin is going there too. Let's talk to Laura Bicker, our China correspondent. Laura, what can you tell us about the Lavrov visit?
Well, when it comes to this visit, it comes at a time when both Russia and China are having discussions about what's happening in the Strait of Hormuz. We were expecting Vladimir Putin to arrive sometime this year, perhaps May or June. We did expect that visit to come after Donald Trump's expected visit in the middle of May. So that's what we're hearing right now, that the two are coordinating plans, but also discussing potential peace plans for the Middle East. Now, we know behind the scenes, and I had it confirmed yesterday, that China is trying to push Tehran to get back to the negotiating table. And I think that's China's key priority here. They want peace in the Middle East in order for global stability and order for its own export-driven economy to work effectively.
And for the Russians, what is in the Putin visit?
In terms of, this is the kind of annual check-in between Vladimir Putin and President Xi. They like to kind of meet regularly. And this is a kind of annual check-in when it comes to Vladimir Putin's visit. But I think it will take on added importance as Russia and China try to collaborate on what is happening in terms of the United States and the unpredictability of the United States. What China is trying to do is build a kind of loose alliance, a coalition where it is therefore the beacon of stability in comparison to the unpredictability of current Washington administration.
Laura Bigger in China. Thank you.
Let's turn at 6:15 to the business news. Sean joins us from Salford, where business are digesting that IMF warning, not just of a possible global recession, Sean, if the conflict in Iran continues, but also the warning that Britain will be hit hardest of the rich economies.
Yeah, and not just digesting it, Nick. They're living it, aren't they? We got a bit of a taster yesterday of how the knock-on effects can hit businesses from Tom Behan, the co-chief executive at the sportswear brand Castor. He told us that the delays to air freight due to the war in the Middle East was disrupting his business.
Most worryingly, we are starting to see some airline carriers, cargo freight companies reduce the amount of flights that they're doing so product physically can't get to its destination. That is something that is causing a lot of concern, but it does change on an almost daily basis.
So that was Tom Behan there of Castor. All of that coming alongside these warnings from the IMF, this international organisation with 191 member countries, where when it's making those latest predictions for what might happen to the global economy, one of those scenarios, if the oil price stays well above $100 a barrel throughout the year, says the world would come close to a recession, growth hit in a way that's only really happened during a few previous crises. And of course, if things like air freight are starting to be hit as well, you can see how that disruption can ripple right through the global economy. Brandon Freed is the executive director of the Air Forwarders Association, the trade body that represents hundreds of American freight forwarding companies. Brandon, good morning. Are you seeing something similar yourself?
Yeah, good morning, Sean. Yeah, you know, the old playbooks are out. The freight forwarding community is constantly rerouting to keep cargo moving, but capacity is tight, rates are up, and volatility is high every day. You know, these Middle Eastern carriers, the Emirates and Etihad and Qatar, they run about 18-20% of the world's cargo through those hubs, which are now constrained. And now they're operating below normal capacity. So that's causing congestion and delays.
Where and how?
It's backing up into Europe. It's backing up into the United States. We're also seeing ocean cargo delayed significantly because they're dropping containers off at other ports other than the actual destinations. And of course, shippers are trying to move that cargo. They either have to do it via land or they're taxing air freight as well. So it's just adding to the disruption. This is broad and on a wide scale.
How does this compare to, you know, other crises? The IMF has been comparing this to, you know, potentially, if the oil price stays this high, to some of the worst economic crises we've seen. But in
pandemic. I mean, you know, the pandemic was when we were last taxed significantly, but that was on a worldwide scale. This is regional, but it is starting to have a worldwide effect.
Does the rising cost of jet fuel add to this?
Significantly, as does the cost of rerouting the cargo, risk insurance, added security measures. And we're watching, you know, these airlines have to watch fuel very carefully because just a penny increase has a significant increase effect on their fuel costs. And of course, that goes right to the shippers, to the customers.
So how much have rates increased for air freight?
Well, it varies, but significantly, you know, we've seen rates 20-30% higher in some instances.
And does that get passed through to the end customer?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we as an industry, we can only absorb this for so long. Sooner or later, the actual customer pays for it.
Is this going to be a shock to the system, the way we've seen some of those price shocks in recent years?
Well, I think it's going to pervade. It's, you know, through the system. It's going to add to the the complexity of the problem, obviously, and you know, it's going to increase the cost of doing business and the cost of living.
And what about supply issues further down the line? We're well aware, sort of talking about, talking to businesses, that at this time of the year, you know, you can be thinking about that Christmas delivery period already. Are you envisaging some supply issues throughout the year?
Yeah, well, you know, obviously a lot of these shippers plan well in advance, but if this conflict continues for an inordinate amount of time, yeah, we could see those delays that you just described.
Would you expect, are you seeing any signs of shortages?
Not at this point, but of course, you know, obviously in air cargo, we're usually, you know, we're the pressure valve for global trade. And as time progresses, I think that we're going to see more demand, and that will probably signal supply chain shortages more.
Brandon, thank you for your time. Brandon Freed there from that American Air Forwarders Association Executive Director there. George Godber with us, fund manager at Polar Capital. George, just the numbers here, good morning to you, behind what the International Monetary Fund is talking about. Are investors reflecting these views that the UK could be hardest hit?
So, yes, they are. If you look at the performance of UK government bonds, which have done worse than our sort of international counterparts, they have sold off more. That's reflective of two things. It is the vulnerability of our current energy policy, which means that we're much more liable to shocks than, say, our European peers, France or Germany. And it's the implication that that then has onto interest rates and inflation. Now, I just kind of, you know, just give a little caveat. I often find when the IMF do produce these reports, it's sort of very much, you know, as crisis is sort of disappearing into the rearview mirror. So I hope that it's ultimately just going to be a prediction rather than a sort of statement of fact.
Something else that is sort of a reflection of the rearview mirror is the comments we've seen from BP about exceptional profits it's going to be making because of the higher oil price, and bank profits as well. Shattering records is the front page of the Financial Times this morning.
So BP had, you know, very good performance in its trading division, but, you know, was impacted by weaker production because that was, you know, they're suffering from the same problems in the Middle East that, you know, we're all focused on. BP is undergoing a sort of more structural turnaround and improvement in its business. Yesterday, we heard from three big US banking giants, JP Morgan, Citi and Wells Fargo. And obviously, if we now think about what that'll mean for our banking giants, you know, Lloyds, Barclays, NatWest, we'll all hear from later in the month. Actually, some of them were reporting sort of good, you know, current trading in their trading divisions, but JP Morgan and Wells Fargo both actually ended up cutting their full year outlooks. And so, you know, there was some disappointment there because obviously banks do get hit when economies get hit.
George, thank you for your time this morning. George Godber, fund manager at Polar Capital. Now, those big banks will very much have had their eye, and they have had their, commenting on the latest developments in the world of artificial intelligence, this new AI model from Anthropic called Claude Mythos, that apparently so much more powerful and potentially an increased threat to operating systems. It's jumped right up the agenda of some of the world's biggest banks. Boss of JP Morgan talking about how Mythos has meant there's a lot more vulnerabilities to the systems here. And he's jumped right up the agenda as well of the next meeting of the UK's major financial institutions, including the Bank of England, this meeting where they look at the resilience of the finance sector. Anthropic has said it's not going to release this latest model to the public yet. It has been talking with many of these businesses because it said it could uncover vulnerabilities in every major operating system and web browser out there. Alexandra Musavizadeh is co-founder of Evident, which is an intelligence platform that benchmarks and tracks the adoption of AI across the financial services sector. Alexandra, good morning. Can you just explain what this Mythos is all about?
Yeah, good morning. Yes, it is. It's a real concern for the sector. It is a tool that can, you know, automatically identify vulnerabilities that have gone undetected in the past. And so it's a real concern for the entire sector. And it's definitely keeping the CEOs of the major banks up at night for sure, because the tool is so powerful, great to have on the inside, but you really don't want to have bad actors use this tool because it can identify vulnerabilities in the security net of the bank. So there is a real concern. This is being discussed, a lot in every bank in the entire sector of how to mitigate these risks. And of course, trying to hold off as long as possible for Anthropic to release this model. But the question, of course, is, you know, these capabilities are being developed by other, tech companies as well.
Well, of course. So what on earth do we do? I mean, I see that Anthropic, you know, has had a bit of praise. Christine Lagarde, the European Central Bank, was praising Anthropic, amongst others, for what they've done here and their engagement with other industries with a model that could provide a lot of threats. But how on earth do you counter it when there are other companies that might not be doing that?
Yeah, well, I think this is where the government has to step in and create some restrictions on these kinds of models to be released. The question is just, you know, can you control the companies in terms of their release timetable?
Which government, though? I mean, is it any good if the UK just did this by itself?
Yeah, no, that's the big joker, right? That's the big question. Because one thing is, even if you could control the big Anthropics and OpenAIs and even the Groks, but China can develop this tool, you know, DeepSeek and Qwen are very advanced models and will for sure have these kinds of tools on the horizon. And so the best thing you can do is try to accelerate the capabilities of the banks to create and update their systems to mitigate these risks. So giving them an early look into what this tool can do is, of course, one of the first steps.
And Alexandra, is it fair to say, just given others that have sort of spoken to in the industry, that this may be exposing more vulnerabilities, but it doesn't necessarily mean that anybody can just pick up this model and hack into and bring down a system instantaneously?
No, not instantaneously, but you do have very capable people that if they did want to do harm, the tool is out there now to sort of to set it up so it can. It's not something that an everyday person can organize around and bring down the entire financial services sector for sure.
Alexandra Moussa-Vizadeh, thank you for your time. Co-founder of Evident, one of the numbers that was highlighted to me around all of this with this latest development was what might have taken a few years before to expose vulnerabilities in a system can now potentially take less than 1 hour. So that is why it is higher up the agenda, but we will see the consequences, of course.
Thank you for that, Sean. 26 minutes past six. Carthy is here with the sport.
Morning. Thank you very much. Liverpool are out of the Champions League. Two goals from Ousmane Dembele gave Paris Saint-Germain a 2-0 victory on the night, a 4-0 win over the two legs. PSG move into the semi-finals, as Ian Dennis reports from Anfield.
It was a high-quality contest and Liverpool forced Paris Saint-Germain to dig deep, and with 18 minutes remaining there was jeopardy. However, a Dembele double changed that. A fine finish after 72 minutes. He slotted a second in stoppage time. Marquinhos had made a marvellous goal-saving block in the first half, but after the break Liverpool ramped it up. Safonov made two important saves, but Liverpool needed a break and had a penalty awarded, but it was overruled by VAR. They gave it a go, but PSG deserved to go through, the superior side over the two legs.
Defeat for Liverpool means they will end the season without silverware, but their manager Arne Slot is trying to take positives from the Champions League into the rest of their Premier League season.
The future looks very bright for this team, for this club, because we've shown that we can compete with the champions of Europe in our stadium. To be the dominant team, not many teams can be dominant against the Paris Saint-Germain and generate so many chances as we did. But yeah, chances is one thing, scoring is a second.
Atletico Madrid are also through to the semi-finals. They beat Barcelona 3-2 overall. Arsenal host Sporting in the Champions League tonight. England women had an important 1-0 win over world champions Spain in their Women's World Cup qualifier. England lost the 2023 World Cup final to Spain, but the England manager Serena Wiegmann feels that experience helped them last night at Wembley.
You want to learn from every game, but we're playing, Spain is the world champion and their DNA is that they're so good on the ball and they always want to have the ball and they always want to press forwards. Sometimes you just need to defend more. What we say, we can win by any means, and that's what we showed today.
The Lionesses are 3 points clear at the top of their group. Only the top team qualifies automatically. Wales women had a 4-0 win over Albania. Scotland scored a late equaliser to claim a 1-1 draw with top seeds Belgium. Northern Ireland beat Malta 4-0 and the Republic of Ireland had a 3-2 win over Poland. Tennis and British number one Cam Norrie faces America's Ethan Quinn in the second round of the Barcelona Open this afternoon. And you may have heard the editor of Wisden, the prestigious cricketer's almanac, on this programme yesterday. Well, Lawrence Booth had described the England team's 4-1 Ashes series defeat as feckless, legless and reckless in his editor's notes. Well, the ECB later released an interview with the England captain Ben Stokes, who said suggestions of a rift with coach Brendan McCullum have been overstated, but Stokes acknowledged that he must work with the head coach in a slightly different way going forward.
He's got a good turn of phrase, that guy, hasn't he?
Feckless, reckless and legless is a good line.
No wonder they had to react to your interview. Thanks.
How has history shaped classical music?
Of course, it often happens in history that changes in music come with changes in society.
From the birth of musical notation to the digital streaming revolution. Join me, Gillian Moore, and leading experts, including Michael Wood, for an epic journey through 1,000 years of classical music.
What a miracle it is that we can still listen to music from so long ago.
Key Changes, Radio 3's essential history of classical music. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
The time, 6:30. You're listening to Today on Radio 4. Nick Robinson, Justin Webb and Alan Smith with the news.
The Chancellor will meet the US Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent in Washington today after criticising what she called the folly of America's decision to go to war with Iran without an exit plan. Speaking to the Daily Mirror, Rachel Reeves said that as a result, the vital Strait of Hormuz waterway was now blocked and families and businesses in the UK were feeling the impact. The US Vice President J.D. Vance says Iran's negotiators want to make a deal, but warned that mistrust between the two countries could not be solved overnight. He was speaking after President Trump suggested talks could resume in the coming days following their collapse on Sunday. Key sticking points include the Strait of Hormuz and Tehran's nuclear program. A BBC investigation has revealed a shadow industry of legal advisers charging thousands of pounds to help migrants pretend to be gay in order to stay in the country. Those whose visas are due to run out are being given fake cover stories for their asylum claims and are instructed in how to obtain fabricated evidence, including supporting letters and photos at LGBT events. As the civil war in Sudan enters its fourth year, donors, including the UK, are meeting in Berlin to discuss ways to mobilise aid and revive peace talks in what's become the world's largest humanitarian crisis. More than 12 million people have been displaced in the power struggle between the regular army and the paramilitary rapid support forces. A new women's health strategy for England is being launched today, featuring a scheme described as a patient power payment. The initiative will allow women to share feedback on their care, with funding potentially directed to areas where improvements are needed. The strategy, first published by the Conservative government in 2022, has now been updated by Labour. And work is beginning on a six-month taxpayer-funded operation to clear thousands of tonnes of waste illegally dumped along a field at Kidlington in Oxfordshire. Up to 30 trucks a day will take away the rubbish, which includes tyres, shredded plastic and household waste.
Thank you, Alan. It's now 28 minutes to seven. Donald Trump's Treasury Secretary says that a little economic disruption is a price worth paying for ensuring that Iran does not have nuclear weapons. That's not quite how the Chancellor sees things. The two are due to meet in Washington, D.C. today at the IMF conference, from where I spoke to our economics editor, Faisal Islam.
Some fairly sharp words from the Chancellor arriving in D.C., saying that she was frustrated, that she was angry at the folly of the war and its economic consequences. Now, we heard sort of obviously very differently directly from Scott Bessent, the U.S. Treasury Secretary. He told me that... Yes, there could be what he said, a small economic hit for a few weeks, but the consequences of that, of the idea that the Iranians could have a nuclear weapon that could hit London, would obviously be far worse for the economy. Now, they will meet today, and you know, there's a variety of things they want to talk about. The UK joining forces with France, and there'll be a summit on Friday to try to see how once a peace deal is done, the Strait of Hormuz could be in some way be relieved of its of the situation right now. But I'm getting the sense from the Americans that you get this justification for the war and the fact that the economics does not mean that they shouldn't have taken the action that they're taking, but also trying to communicate to colleagues in other countries, but also to the markets, that this only has a few more weeks to run, though we have heard that before.
The president has been saying, we're told to Fox News, that the war is over. But that doesn't mean the Strait of Hormuz is open, as the French finance minister has been telling you.
Yes. I mean, he was telling me that it would take some time to unknot, as he put it, the situation in the Strait of Hormuz. There are still hundreds of ships that have been stuck there. The consequences of the situation we see in the Strait is obviously material, not just for oil and gas, but also a range of other sectors, from helium to the fertilizer sector, important for food. And it would take some time, he told me, for this situation to normalize. That's even if you've got a peace. And at the minute, you don't just have a blockade, but you have a blockade on the blockade from the US. The French finance minister sort of confirming that, you know, the other G7 countries have no intention of joining in the US blockade on Iranian ships. And we just wait. We wait to see what these peace negotiations, the negotiations with Iran, the Israeli negotiations with Lebanon, where they go.
Faisal Islam, our economics editor in Washington, D.C. Thank you.
25 to 7 is the time. There is a war over defence spending, a war within the Labour Party. Let's talk to Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent, who is on the line. It's a serious business, Henry.
Yeah, absolutely, Justin. And actually, a lot of this pretty serious dispute, which was given life by George Robertson, the former Labour Defence Secretary, former NATO Secretary General, who authored the government's strategic defence review, is about the defence investment plan. And the defence investment plan is how the government said, when it accepted the recommendations of George Robertson's review last year, it would spell out how it planned to meet those recommendations. It was due last autumn. It still hasn't been published. I'm told one reason for the delay is that John Healey, the defence secretary, is making the point within government that since the strategic defence review was published last year, the demands on the British military have only increased. For example, the possibility that if there were a ceasefire in Ukraine, the UK would commit armed forces personnel there. Or likewise, some of the implications of what's going on in the Strait of Hormuz. And I think the other thing to bear in mind here is that Keir Starmer has not only committed to increase defence spending to 3% of GDP by the end of the next parliament, so around about 2034, but also that at the Munich Security Conference in February, he said, it is clear we are going to have to spend more faster. So to those in government on one side of this argument, this row is being seen as an early test of how committed he is to meeting that promise.
And yet, the Times reporting today that Rachel Reeves is certainly not committed to it, actually, or not committed to coming up with money that she feels she hasn't got.
Well, look, there's various different time horizons over which spending is being argued over here. So the Treasury did make commitments under the spending review process to increase spending in defence over the next few years. But the defence investment plan is about the next 10 years. And then you also have the Ministry of Defence saying that they need more money for the current plans. Sir Keir Starmer, I think, is ultimately going to have to make the decision here. That's something he acknowledged at a committee of MPs last month. He said, we are finalising that, speaking about the defence investment plan. We're nearly there. It's my job to resolve it, and resolve it I will. Well, he has not yet resolved it. Those in government acknowledge there is a decision that he still has to make about the pace and scale of the investment. And look, I mean, this is about defence, but actually it's about the broader political and economic picture facing this government, which is that Labour ministers, Labour MPs, Labour voters would like spending, indeed believes the country needs investment in various areas, which on the current growth trajectory, in the current global economic climate, and under current plans on tax and borrowing, the government is struggling to deliver all of simultaneously.
Henry Zeffman, thank you.
That, incidentally, will be the agenda for a conversation we have with the Treasury Minister working with Rachel Reeves at 8:10. The time now, 22 minutes to 7. Well, it looks like there'll be fresh talks between the United States and Iran. possibly over the next 2 days in Pakistan. James Landale, our diplomatic correspondent, joins us now. Who's saying this, James, and how significant is it?
Well, certainly the mood music out of Washington at the moment is optimistic in tone. Donald Trump is saying the talks could resume in a couple of days. He said overnight a deal is preferable. He also, in an interview with Fox News, said the war is very close to being over. His deputy, J.D. Vance, said that Mr. Trump wants what he called a grand bargain and said he was convinced that the Iranians wanted to make a deal. So the Americans at the moment are making lots of optimistic noises about the possibility of A, talks resuming, and B, the possibility of them making some progress. Now, look, you know, on one level, is this another attempt by the Americans to try to calm the markets because they have done that in the past? But or is it also actually saying, look, there is the possibility of a deal? You've got, in recent days, off the back of the last talks at the weekend that didn't produce any results, some details emerging in the US media about where the positions were. Say, for example, on the nuclear issue, the Americans were saying, well, why don't the Iranians suspend their enrichment of uranium nuclear fuel for 20 years? The Iranians apparently were talking about something well under 10 years, about the five-year mark, plus or minus. So if they're at least on that pitch, and they're talking about years for a suspension of enrichment, potentially you could in theory argue that, you know, that there's a space between both sides into which a compromise could be found.
How different, James, would that sort of deal be from the one that Barack Obama made and Donald Trump condemned as the worst deal ever?
Well, that's a really good question, because it's a point that others have pointed out, which is that the deal that the Americans struck, the international deal in 2015, the JCPOA as it was known, did involve the suspension of certain practices and enrichment and things like that for a certain time period. But remember, that deal took months and years to negotiate. So I think if the American noises about talks resuming, the test for that is not necessarily going to be how quickly are they going to happen. It's going to be how long are they going to take? Mm. Who turns up? Do you have the technical experts to go through this? And are they expected to have some kind of big political direction and then time when the experts can get round a table and slowly but surely grind out a deal that it can actually sustain? And I think that will be the test.
James Landale, our diplomatic correspondent, thank you.
At 19 minutes to 7, let us have a look at what the papers are saying. The front page of the Times: minister calls for single-sex spaces to be more inclusive. This is a year, or marking a year, since the Supreme Court ruled that gender was related to biological sex in reference to the Equality Act. In other words, spaces needed to be protected for people based on their biological sex. Well, the Times says on its front page that Bridget Phillipson has told the equality regulator that it must tone down its guidance on single-sex spaces and make it more inclusive before she presents it to Parliament. So she is the Women and Equalities Minister. She hasn't yet published that new guidance. The Times claims, at least, that the code of practice has been submitted to ministers but has not yet been approved because, at least in part, the tone of the document is not inclusive enough. Though it also quotes a source close to Bridget Phillipson herself saying they completely dispute that, that they've asked the guidance to be toned down. They say the request is merely that they ensure clarity for all kinds of services.
On the front page of the Mirror is the interview we were just hearing Faisal Islam refer to, the Chancellor's interview, which the Mirror sums up as saying no exit plan, no idea. Reeves' fury at Trump, and the fury of those who dislike the war may be increased by the news in the front page of the Financial Times that Wall Street bank earnings shatter records as traders thrive on Iran war volatility. We're going to be talking later in the programme about the economic impact of the conflict. It's not too bad, it turns out, if you work for JP Morgan, because JP Morgan Chase reported the highest ever revenues from its trading business and net income, second only to 2024, according to the FT.
And there's quite a lot about the demise of butterflies as well in several of the papers. For instance, The Mail: Britain's butterflies dying out, with 33 native species fighting an increasingly urgent battle for survival. I feel this is something we've talked about pretty regularly on the programme anyway, it seems, from the papers today, quoting the head of science at Butterfly Conservation, one of the main groups leading a scheme to protect butterflies, that there is still a very urgent problem to be addressed.
Not only have we discussed it, but we will hear from that very individual later in the programme talking about what we can learn from the decline in certain butterfly species about what's happening to climate change on the planet.
But before the butterflies, the government has threatened, is threatened with a rebellion by Labour MPs. It happened last night over plans to restrict repeat protests and demonstrations. Here is our parliamentary correspondent, Sean Curran.
Over the next few weeks, MPs and peers will be engaged in the process known as parliamentary ping-pong, as the government seeks to get new laws onto the statute book ahead of the King's speech next month.
The clerk will now proceed to read the orders of the day.
Crime and Policing Bill, consideration of Lords' Amendments.
The government suffered a string of defeats when the legislation was considered in the Lords. Now the Home Office Minister, Sarah Jones, wanted MPs to reject or rewrite many of the changes to what she said was the largest criminal justice bill in a generation.
This bill will support the government's mission to halve knife crime and violence against women and girls in a decade and give our police and law enforcement agencies the tools they need to tackle antisocial behaviour, sexual violence, terrorism and online harms.
Last week, the government announced that it would introduce its own changes to the bill to ban online pornography featuring family members and step relations in the face of a possible rebellion by MPs and peers. And the minister said she was proposing further changes to hold the bosses of tech firms responsible if their websites and platforms failed to remove intimate images of people that had been shared without their consent.
Amendment 256A strengthens platform and senior executive accountability by making it a criminal offence for a service which breaches an enforcement decision by Ofcom on duties to deal with and remove reported non-consensual intimate images. This means that senior executives of the service could be criminally liable for the breach.
The Labour MP, Jessa Sarto, had campaigned for tougher laws on online pornography and tried to change the bill last year.
Sadly, half of all sexual abuse cases against children are perpetrated by a step-parent or family member. And given we are increasingly living in an age of blended families, permitting the depiction of this abuse is particularly pernicious.
For the Conservatives, Matt Vickers said the Lords had strengthened the legislation, but he complained that earlier in the process, the government had rejected changes proposed by opposition MPs.
On fly-tipping, pornography and increasing sentences for knife crime. Indeed, this bill could also have provided a real opportunity to tackle the scourge of off-road bikes, to support this country's tradesmen with real action on tool theft and to remove yet more knives from our streets by increasing stop and search.
But the government faced the prospect of a rebellion over a change introduced by ministers in the Lords, which would require police officers in England and Wales to consider the cumulative effect of demonstrations and protests when deciding whether or not to impose conditions. A Labour backbencher, Andy MacDonald, complained that MPs hadn't been given the chance to vote on the proposals, which he called a dangerous erosion of civil liberties.
This Parliament has long since immortalised in our celebrations of the cumulative and persistent protests of the suffragettes and of the anti-apartheid movement marked by the plaque in honour of Nelson Mandela in Westminster Hall. If the government was confident of its amendment, Madam Deputy Speaker, it would put it to a vote.
And Max Wilkinson for the Liberal Democrats said while his party supported parts of the bill, it opposed the protest measures.
We are deeply disturbed by the use of this bill to further erode the protest rights of British people. These are hard-won freedoms that were won by the suffragettes and others, trade unionists and more, over many, many years. And the past government and this one are recklessly taking them away for short-term political expedience.
The Minister, Sarah Jones, said the Home Secretary had proposed the changes following the attack at Heaton Park Synagogue in Manchester last October, when two men were killed.
We are simply saying that when police are looking at whether they impose conditions, they must look, rather than they can look, at cumulative disruption. That is a small change that will actually make a big difference to people who are currently scared and intimidated by persistent protests outside, in particular, mosques and Jewish places of worship.
At the end of the debate on the bill, MPs spent 2.5 hours voting on individual changes, and then they were asked to reject a large group of amendments that had been bundled together, including the proposal on protests. The government got its way, winning the final division by 247 votes to 21, a majority of 226. The bill will now go back to the Lords.
Sean Curran reporting on yesterday in Parliament. It brings us to 12 minutes to 7. A battle won by robots. That is the claim being made to describe the news that for the first time since the war began in Ukraine, Ukrainian forces say they have retaken territory seized by the Russians using unmanned vehicles and drones alone. Let us talk to Shashank Joshi, the Economist defence editor, who is on the line. Morning to you. Shashank, what do we know actually about what happened?
Morning, Justin. We don't know very much. All we know is that Volodymyr Zelensky was in Germany this week. He was trying to agree a drone deal, and therefore he was talking about drones and the utility they have in his war. And he revealed or claimed, I'd say, given what we know of the context, that an enemy position was taken only by unmanned ground systems and drones. And I think we later learned that this was Ukraine's third separate assault brigade, where they essentially had been using these UAVs and these UGVs to take sort of a lot of Russian ground without any casualties of their own.
So essentially, the Russians. Well, we'll get on to the skepticism in a second. But what they're saying is that the Russians essentially surrendered to semi-autonomous at least vehicles and drones.
That's right. That's the claim.
Yeah. Okay. And your skepticism is along what lines?
It's only that this is a slow, gradual process in this war. It's not a sudden event. You know, this isn't a breakthrough. In that, in the December 2024, there was the battle for Lipetsk in Kharkiv region, and that was again billed as the first uncrewed, unmanned assault. That was with drones, which have been used extensively in this conflict, UAVs, aerial vehicles, but also with uncrewed ground vehicles, providing suppressing fire, providing assault backup, and we know that steadily the use of these things for logistics, for reconnaissance, has grown and grown and grown. There have also been a couple of other occasions in Zaporizhia in the south, and I think one more, where we have seen kind of all uncrewed assaults. So I think this is being played up as a threshold. I think this just marks the fact that uncrewed vehicles are doing some really remarkable things in this conflict.
There's a difference, though, isn't there, between uncrewed vehicles and vehicles that are making their own autonomous decisions. And what I think some people have wondered about this is the extent to which these are not only uncrewed, but actually doing their own thing without anyone necessarily in charge of them.
It's a completely different thing. You're absolutely right to point that out. And these are, on the whole, almost entirely remote controlled. These are not autonomous in the sense that you're describing. Now, there are some autonomous capabilities. A lot of aerial drones, strike drones, are becoming autonomous, but only when they get within maybe 1 to 2 kilometers of their target and can lock on, which means that when the jamming kicks in, it doesn't knock out the radio signal to the pilot and the drone can still make its way to the target. But that is a minority of strike drones. That's not most of them. And as far as I understand, that is certainly not the majority. In fact, it's not even a very small number of the uncrewed ground vehicles, which really, because they're going over such complex terrain and have to make such complex decisions, on the whole, are being remote control.
How concerned are people, though, and I'm thinking now not necessarily about what has just happened in Ukraine, but more widely as well, how concerned are people that we are heading towards a situation where on battlefields decisions will not be made by flesh and blood human beings?
I think what I always say is we tend to focus on the drone bit, the very end of that so-called kill chain where the drone is slamming into a target. And in a way, that's the simplest bit because you're recognizing a tank, you're recognizing an object. The operator knows what's in the area. The much more really complex and challenging area is so-called decision support systems, things like Project Maven, which is a decision support system that's used by NATO, but also by the US, used in Iran. And that is where hundreds or thousands of targets at scale using software, including AI. And then the human may be approving all of those targets, but they may be faced with so many targets they can't possibly approve or understand all of them with great confidence. So they may be pressing a button saying, yes, this is fine, yes, okay, but they don't really fully understand what the software is doing at speed. And in a high-intensity war with Russia or China, the fear is that the reliance on software could eventually become overwhelming and really muddle human judgment. I think a lot of people, including NATO, former NATO officers I talked to, are legitimately concerned about that in the future, as much as they recognise the promise of the technology as well.
Shashank Joshi of The Economist, thank you.
It's coming up to 6 minutes to seven now. Why do women wait longer for medical care than men? And why are their appeals for pain relief all too often ignored in hospital? Those are just two of the questions which lie behind the Women's Health Strategy, launched under the last Tory government 4 years ago, now being updated by this Labour government. Joyce Harper, the Professor of Reproductive Science at the Institute for Women's Health at University College London, told me what she hopes this will achieve.
It was obviously very important to have a Women's Health Strategy, which we have had now for several years, but it is something that is a work in progress. And as the report says, we need to keep listening to women, seeing what they need and make sure we address that need. So it's very good to have a review and to see where we have got to so far and immediately where we need to go to in the next few years.
Crucially, this is about hearing the voices of women, the voices of women patients, which all too often are ignored.
Absolutely. And women have complicated biology. We have periods, we have menstrual cycles, we have fertility and pregnancy and menopause. And all of those situations can cause issues. They can cause symptoms and problems for women's health. So it's brilliant that these are now being addressed. But we have a lot more work to do to make sure that we're listening to women, addressing their needs and making sure that we really give them proper medical care and support if they need it.
How concerning is it to you that it is women waiting for treatment on the NHS who are waiting longer than other patients? Their waiting list, in other words, has got longer in the past year.
Yes, this is really unacceptable. These waiting lists are not acceptable at all, and we really have to do more. A lot of the conditions I've mentioned, they are complex, so they're not just one symptom that are leading to a problem. They can lead to a number of issues for women. So we need to have this holistic view, and we need to make sure that these issues are addressed immediately, as soon as we can, with as short as we can waiting list. Some of these are causing women serious symptoms that are affecting their quality of life, their ability to work, their ability to function. So we've got to get those waiting lists down.
Striking rhetoric from the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, who says that the healthcare system all too often gaslights women. Spell out what you think he means by that.
Well, the trouble with women's health through the years that lots of women feel that their problem is not a problem enough to really get medical care. So women forever have dealt with, for example, painful and difficult periods, and they've just put up with it. They've seen other women around them and they think, oh, well, maybe I'm just making a fuss about nothing. So this has been unacceptable. We've got to treat every woman as an individual and make sure that if their symptoms are really affecting them, that they are listened to and they are treated accordingly and not gaslit at all.
Professor Joyce Harper of UCL, thank you very much for joining us. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, is going to be talking about that on Woman's Hour at 10 on Radio 4.
At 3 minutes to seven, though, let us look ahead to Friday here on Radio 4.
The new series of the News Quiz returns with your host, Andy Zaltzman.
You can just make up your own jokes there.
And a panel of comedians trying to find the funny in the news.
What am I talking about?
Apparently we no longer produce children.
Don't make them here anymore. Too much red tape.
It's a niche fetish, but whatever works. The UK is getting sunnier.
It was researchers in Spain that have said this. They're just saying that because they don't want us there.
I do not fly tip. Unless the fly has given me especially good service.
The new series of the News Quiz starts on Friday night at 6:30. To listen on your smart speaker, just say, play Radio 4.
Now it's time to play Thomas Schaffernecker with the weather.
Thanks very much. Good morning to you. It's looking pretty grey out there at the moment. Low pressure close by, weather fronts crossing the country, but it's not cold. Temperatures are hovering around 10 Celsius at the moment in most towns and cities. Most of the rain at the moment is across Scotland and also other western parts of the UK. So I think in the first half of the day, we can expect further rain in Scotland and western fringes of the British Isles, so certainly Northern Ireland, Wales and also southwestern parts of England. Further east today, there is a few spits and spots of rain around at the moment, but I think the rain, the proper rain, won't reach you until much later on. So we'll split the UK in half. First half of the day in the west, expect rain and then sunny spells and showers. In the east of the country, the rain will reach you later on in the day. Now, our top temperatures will range from around 10 Celsius in the far north of Scotland, 13 expected in Belfast and around 16 in Manchester. In the southeast of England, highs should reach around 18 or so. Now, this evening and overnight, we can expect a little bit more rain, and then the night is going to be quite showery in Scotland and Northern Ireland. In the south and the southeast, it should be clear. Not particularly cold overnight tonight, 6 to 8 Celsius. And then tomorrow, brawlies to hand, we've got another day of showers. The showers will be probably cropping up right from the morning onwards, and they are possible almost anywhere across the country. And really, rest of the week, it's a story of sunny spells and showers. That's the forecast.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Nick Robinson.
It's 7 o'clock on Wednesday, the 15th of April. The headlines this morning: the Chancellor, who's in Washington, has criticised what she's called the folly of President Trump's decision to go to war with Iran without an exit plan. The BBC investigation has found that some migrants are being given legal advice to pretend that they're gay in order to claim asylum and stay in the UK.
You are required to provide evidence to the Home Office demonstrating that if you are gay, you are indeed affiliated with a gay organisation. We can claim that you have actually been associated with us all along.
And one other headline: hospices in England say they're facing a growing financial crisis.
Also in the next hour, we'll hear how the King plans to tread the diplomatic tightrope during his state visit to the United States following tensions between Trump and Starmer. And what can 50 years of counting butterflies tell us about the state of nature?
We've managed to keep all the butterflies that we've had on these transect routes, and we've actually gained some because there are some butterflies moving into the Chilterns that are coming up from the south of England with global warming.
We're going to be hearing about the work of those citizen scientists a little later on. That's all after the BBC News, read for us this morning by Alan Smith.
The Chancellor will hold talks with the US Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent in Washington today after saying she's very frustrated and angry that the US went to war with Iran without an exit plan. In an interview with the Daily Mirror, Rachel Reeves criticised what she called the folly of President Trump's decision. She said that as a result, the vital Strait of Hormuz waterway was now blocked and families and businesses in the UK were feeling the impact. Yesterday, the International Monetary Fund predicted the economic fallout from the conflict would hit the UK harder than any other advanced economy. From the IMF's meeting in Washington, here's our economics editor, Faisal Islam.
Among the world's finance ministers and central bankers gathered here at the IMF, there is concern that another geopolitical crisis has hampered economic recovery and threatened household living standards. The Chancellor's public frustration and anger at the economic impact of the war might be tested at her bilateral meeting with her US counterpart, Scott Bessent, later today. He told the BBC yesterday the current disruptions were worth it to avoid the economic impact of a nuclear strike on London. The French finance minister, Roland Lescure, told the BBC that any resolution was still a way off.
I think there's a willingness to keep on talking, but at the end of the day, there's no escaping. The Strait of Hormuz is the economic knot of this crisis. And if we don't open it peacefully and lastly, and that's going to take a while, then we're going to keep on missing 12 million barrels a day for a long time.
On Friday, the UK and France will host an international conference on reopening the Strait of Hormuz, though only after a peace deal is agreed. Market oil prices had dipped yesterday on the hope of further peace talks, but the concern now is about the physical supplies of gas, diesel, fertiliser products and helium that were due to have been delivered around now but are still trapped in the Gulf.
The US Vice President J.D. Vance has said that Iran's negotiators want to make a deal, but mistrust between the nations cannot be solved overnight. He was speaking after President Trump suggested that talks with Iran could restart soon after they collapsed on Sunday. Here's our North America correspondent Peter Bowes.
Speaking before an audience of the conservative campus network Turning Point USA, J.D. Vance said he felt very good about where the US stood with Iran. He acknowledged that mistrust between the two countries, spanning several decades, could not be overcome overnight, but he believed the Iranian negotiators wanted to make a deal. He reiterated that it was the president's policy that Iran could not have a nuclear weapon and that negotiations to that end were taking place. Speaking to the New York Post yesterday, Mr. Trump said peace talks could be happening over the next 2 days.
The US military says it's completely halted Iran's trade by sea. In a statement, US Central Command said a blockade of Iranian ports had been fully implemented, cutting off all maritime trade in less than 36 hours. A BBC investigation has revealed a shadow industry of legal advisers charging thousands of pounds to help migrants pretend to be gay in order to stay in the country. Those whose visas are due to run out are being given fake cover stories for their asylum claims and are instructed in how to obtain fabricated evidence, including supporting letters and photos at LGBT events. Our politics investigations correspondent Billy Kenber reports.
The UK's asylum process offers protection to people who can't return to their home countries because they would be in danger. But our investigation reveals how some advisers are extracting fees from international students and workers who want to stay in the country. One adviser, Tanisha Khan, told a BBC undercover reporter his only hope was to claim asylum by pretending to be gay.
I will fully prepare you for the interview by compiling a comprehensive package for you, including photographs of you at clubs, various other pieces of supporting evidence.
She told the reporter to go to an East London event for gay asylum seekers to help with his application. We secretly filmed a succession of men there, saying many attending weren't genuinely gay. Tanisha Khan denied all wrongdoing and said there'd been communication difficulties because she wasn't a fluent Urdu speaker. The Home Office said anyone found trying to exploit the system would face the full force of the law.
The state visit by King Charles and Queen Camilla to the US later this month will not include a meeting with survivors of the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The couple have faced repeated calls for a meeting in light of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor's ties to the disgraced financier. The former prince has always denied any wrongdoing. Here's our royal correspondent, Sean Coughlin.
There have been calls for the King and Queen to meet Epstein survivors during their visit to the US, but that's been ruled out. Palace sources say they don't want to risk jeopardising any legal action that could bring justice to survivors. However, during the trip, Queen Camilla will meet campaigners seeking to stop violence against women. The visit is taking place at a time of political tensions between the US and the UK, and the Foreign Office says that the meeting between the King and President Trump will show the benefits of being close allies, despite occasional disagreements.
A women's health strategy for England is being unveiled, including a new scheme branded a patient power payment. Women will be able to give feedback about their treatment, which could lead to money being allocated to areas that need improvement. The strategy, first published by the Conservative government in 2022, has now been updated by Labour. Our health editor Hugh Pym reports.
The latest version of the plan comes against a backdrop of criticism that women's voices are often ignored and marginalised by the NHS. Gynaecology has been selected for the first trial of a scheme which will allocate funding to areas identified as inadequate by patients. A new standard of care will be introduced to ensure women are offered appropriate pain relief for invasive gynaecological procedures. BBC analysis shows that there was a 98% increase in this waiting list over the last 6 years, compared with 58% for other conditions. The Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists has welcomed the strategy, but says that despite the government's commitments on waiting lists, the picture for women remains deeply concerning.
Hospices in England and are warning of growing financial crisis that could force them to cut services, close beds and in some cases shut down entirely. Staff from across England are heading to Downing Street to present the Prime Minister with a letter calling for urgent help. As Nomia Iqbal reports.
Hospices say they're being pushed towards a financial cliff edge as rising costs continue to outstrip government funding. Hospice UK says staff costs alone are expected to increase from £1.2 billion in 2024 to more than £1.4 billion by 2026. Yet on average, only around 40% of hospice care is funded by the state, leaving charitable donations to make up the gaps. Last year, the government announced funding of more than £100 million for over 2 years, but providers say it's already run out.
Research suggests the increasingly warm and sunny weather brought by climate change has helped some British butterfly species to flourish. But data from the UK Butterfly Monitoring Scheme shows that many of our most distinctive butterflies are in steep decline. Here's our climate editor, Justin Rowlatt.
The scheme has collected more than 44 million records and has been described as a global gold standard for wildlife surveys. Of the 59 native species monitored, just over half have declined, while the rest have increased. Because butterflies are cold-blooded, warmer weather helps them survive and spread. And with many UK species already at their northern range limit, they can move into northern England and Scotland. However, this depends on suitable habitat. Many species are highly specialised, with caterpillars that rely on one or two rare plants. And their ability to establish new populations is limited, as habitats such as woodland clearings and chalk grasslands are lost or degraded.
That was our climate editor, Justin Rowlatt.
Thank you for that. 9 minutes past seven is the time. What should Rachel Reeves do now to help Britain cope with the fallout from war? She's in Washington today, and as we were hearing in the news, she is angry. She's seeing the US Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, but she's already, even before that meeting, saying she's frustrated about the war and what she calls the lack of planning for what would happen next. But, of course, anger only gets us so far. What actions does the government need to take? Let us talk to Ray Newton-Smith from the CBI, the employers' organisation, who is on the line now. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
As chief executive of the CBI, what is your advice to the government about things that they need to do right now?
Well, I think as the Chancellor herself recognised this week, is we can't address the cost of living challenge for households without also addressing the cost of doing business and helping businesses to invest and grow in the UK. We know that this conflict has shone a light on our high energy costs. In the UK, our energy costs for industry are 60% higher than our peers across Europe. So there are things that the government can do. They're already consulting at the moment through our industrial strategy on a measure to reduce those high energy costs for industry. That's not set to come into place until 2027. We should bring that forward and implement that now so that we can reduce some of those high energy costs for our energy intensive industry.
In practical terms, then, what would that mean doing?
Well, at the moment, there are also measures we can look at in terms of the policy costs which sit on our electricity bills. The government have taken action to remove those for households, to reduce household bills. We can do something similar for businesses to reduce the policy costs off our electricity bills, particularly at a moment when we are trying to encourage people to make a switch to electricity. We're investing in our electricity grid, and this is really important for our energy transition. So we can bring forward some of those measures and implement them now.
And when it comes to supply, one of the disagreements, well, you see Donald Trump saying we should be drilling more in the North Sea. Does the CBI have a view on whether the government needs to change course when it comes to our extraction of oil and gas from the North Sea?
Well, I think what we need to do is recognise the North Sea is a critical part of our energy transition. Oil and gas are part of our energy mix. And there are two important things the government could do. There's the energy profits levy, which hits our North Sea producers. It's reducing investment at the moment in the North Sea. That needs to be reformed. There are proposals on the table which the government are considering. They should implement them now and be clear that they're going to encourage that investment of existing extraction. There are also decisions that are sitting on the desks of government on Jackdaw and Rosebank, which are two of the existing licenses for the North Sea. Those should be given approval, which will help our existing oil and gas extraction. It won't help the overall cost of energy, because those are obviously determined on international markets, but it will impact jobs and investment and tax revenue from the North Sea. And it's a critical part of the skills we need for that energy transition.
And when it comes to spending, it was really striking, wasn't it, to see Harriet Harman and Michael Gove, both of them not necessarily from the same political tradition, I think it's fair to say, saying yesterday it was, wasn't it, that the triple lock on pensions has got to go.
Well, that is one of the measures that we know is really costly for the government. And the government has to make some difficult choices. And I think this energy crisis shows that energy cost is a real challenge. And we absolutely need to focus on that. So these are some of the decisions the Chancellor will be thinking about. We hope to see some positive announcements to help businesses with those high energy costs. But there are also decisions that the government needs to make around the defence investment plan. There was so much focus this week on, you know, that is a plan that is sitting on the desk of government where we need to see the announcements so businesses can really help some of the defence spending we know that we urgently need to make the UK's energy and broader security more resilient.
It's interesting that, because just on the point of defence spending, so there was a drone company, British drone company representative on the World at One yesterday saying, basically, we're thinking of moving abroad because we want to provide things, but we haven't yet been given the go-ahead to provide things, drones and counter-drone technology, to the British government. Are you saying this morning that there is a real economic cost, never mind the defence cost and the potential threat from Russia, etc., there is an economic cost that is being borne now by the delay to the defence plan?
There absolutely is, and it's more of a missed opportunity because the government have set out the defence industrial strategy. They've recognised that defence is one of the critical industries in our overall economic plan, but we are still waiting for the details of where the government will be doing procurement, which we know we need to increase our overall defence capacity. There are large companies and some of these innovative defence tech companies waiting for that investment plan so that they can get on and deliver some of those contracts. The longer we stand around and wait, it has an impact on our capability. And it's important because countries across Europe, across the world, are trying to increase their spending on defence. The longer we delay that, the higher costs we will ultimately pay to increase that capability, which we know we need to see.
Bray Newton-Smith, CEO of the CBI. Thank you.
Quarter past seven, incidentally, we're going to be talking to Treasury Minister at 8:10. We'll raise some of those proposals with him. Now, should stay in Islamabad. Something could be happening. That, at least, is what Donald Trump told a journalist from the New York Post who'd called him from the Pakistani capital. The president clearly hopes that fresh talks are coming and a deal can be done with Iran. His vice president, J.D. Vance, was speaking at an event in Georgia last night and told the crowd that his boss wants to make a grand bargain.
In Pakistan, we made a ton of progress. But the reason why the deal is not yet done is because the president, he really wants a deal where Iran doesn't have a nuclear weapon, Iran is not state sponsoring terrorism, but also the people of Iran can thrive and prosper and join the world economy.
Listening to that, senior correspondent for BBC Persian, Parham Gabodi, joins us now. Morning to you, Parham. What is Morning. Being said in the Iranian media about the prospects of fresh talks?
So, as you mentioned, New York Times yesterday said that Americans came with a proposal that Iran would suspend its nuclear activities for 20 years. However, Iranians did not accept that and had a counter proposal of 5 years of suspensions of all their nuclear activities in order to reach a deal. Iranian foreign minister said the other day that they were inches away from reaching a deal. However, you know, it's not really that easy apart. This is nuclear issue and Iran's nuclear program is definitely one of the sticking points. However, there are many other issues. Back in 2015, when during the Obama administration, when they reached a deal with Iran, known widely as JCPOA, it was only limited to Iran's nuclear program and nuclear enrichment. However, today, the talks are among so many things, including the Strait of Hormuz, which is way more important at this moment than Iran's apparently nuclear program for the United States, for the freedom of navigation in the world, and the United States. people even in the UK are suffering from the gas prices.
Yeah. So what are the Iranians saying about whether they would be willing to reopen the Strait of Hormuz? It is their principal diplomatic weapon, as you're saying, and they won't want to give up control of it for nothing.
Definitely not. So Iranians, the line that all the Iranian authorities are following and what you can hear from them is that they're not going to give up the Strait of Hormuz because they have realized that this is strategically working way better for them. Strategically and financially, economically is working better for them than Iran's nuclear program, because for Iran's nuclear program, they had to spend money. But this one, if they can manage to impose toll on every tanker and ship that crosses the Strait of Hormuz, it is going to be a money-making business for them, apart from a political leverage that can be exerted on not only the United States, but the entire world.
Parham Gabodi of BBC Persian, thanks for joining us.
18 minutes past seven is the time. Companies in the luxury sector have seen weaker demand because of the war in the Middle East. Sean is here with more on that.
Yes, Hermes are the latest fashion house this morning after LVMH and the Gucci and Kering to say that sales have been weaker than expected at the start of this year. Interestingly, this morning saying that spending hit both in the Middle East, but also fewer tourists visiting Paris and buying handbags, designer clothes there as well. Angelina Rasquet is Bloomberg's European luxury and retail reporter. Angelina, morning. Is this impact being further than maybe people might have thought, given tourists in Paris are not buying as much now?
Yes, indeed. Morning. Actually, for Hermès, the results are slightly worse than expected. I think the market was overall expecting that, indeed, the sector would feel the impact of the March disruption to business in the Middle East. But at Hermès, we're seeing not only business disrupted in the Middle East, but also in tourism places such as, they cited the UK, Italy, Switzerland, but also in Asia, Thailand, because obviously Dubai is a big hub for transport, for flights. So that was a pretty negative. And I expect the shares will react negatively when they open at in about 40 minutes in Paris.
Is that anything that people would expect to bounce back? Or is this a longer term issue now if the confidence of flying through the Middle East has changed?
Actually, we asked the CFO of Hermès what was trading looking like at the start of this quarter, and he said traffic in the Middle East is still down, but sales are improving because some of the stores have actually reopened. For instance, stores in Bahrain and Qatar were closed. But we'll have to see if indeed the tourism flows in various regions are still impacted, or if people are happy to spend again when they travel.
And Angelina, when I was sort of drilling down into the numbers of where sales might have been hit particularly hard, it's notable that sort of the ready-to-wear and accessories bit, ready-to-wear clothing section has seen sales fall quite a large amount. You know, you go on the website and you might see a rib trim jacket for £2,500 there. Why would that have seen a bigger hit than perhaps handbags?
Handbags tends to be the most resilient category for Hermès. If you think about the Birkin bag, the Kelly bag, and there tends to be a wait list for those products. So these are still coveted items that you can probably, keep for the long term. They're almost considered as investments. Whereas ready to wear and accessories, it's been a booming category for Hermès in the last few years with the, very talented designers for menswear and womenswear. However, these products, when times are tough, they're probably not considered as a must-have compared to the handbags. So hence why we saw at constant exchange rate, we saw a growth of 0.4%, yeah, which is quite disappointing.
Angelina, thank you very much. Angelina Rasquet from Bloomberg.
And Sean, thank you to you. 22 minutes past seven now. Warm, sunny weather is good for butterflies, right? Well, it seems it's not quite that simple. Our hotter summers do suit some, but not all species. Some are in decline. Counting the number and the type of butterflies can tell us an awful lot, not just about them, not just about our countryside, but about the impact of climate change. And that's what volunteers taking part in the UK Butterfly Monitoring Scheme have been doing for the past 50 years, amongst them Nick Bowles, who lives in the Chilterns.
I've been counting butterflies for just over 40 years, and it's something I'm able to do even more now that I'm retired. I live in the Chilterns, so I'm walking over chalk grasslands mostly and some woodlands too. Sometimes, like now in the spring, you walk round on a transect and you might only see one or two butterflies. Some days, perhaps not even any. But as you get towards the summer, the numbers go up until one of my longer transects, I will be counting over 1,000 butterflies on that one walk on that one day. And that's quite a challenge to get the numbers right then when there's so many.
1,000. Extraordinary, isn't it? Professor Richard Fox joins us now, Head of Science at the organisation Butterfly Conservation. Morning to you.
Good morning.
Before we talk about what you've concluded from 50 years of these surveys, let's just talk about how it works. He walks along, not presumably in a random place. It has to be the same place each year, does it?
Yes, that's absolutely right. So Nick mentioned walking a transect. So a transect is a fixed walk that the volunteer walks week after week, weather permitting, from April to September, counting all of the butterflies that they meet along the way. And this, the UK Butterfly Monitoring Scheme is a fantastic example of this sort of citizen science, telling us what's going on in the natural world. And volunteers, thousands, every year thousands of volunteers go out and walk these butterfly transects, counting the butterflies. And over the last 50 years, they've walked almost 1 million miles in the UK counting butterflies, which is equivalent to walking to the moon and back twice.
And what is it that you've concluded from all that work? I summarised it, is this right, as being hot weather good for some, but not at all good for some species?
Yes. So what the UK Butterfly Monitoring Scheme gives us are long-term trends for almost all of our butterfly, 60 butterfly species. And what we see over the 50 years is that there are many more species have declined than have increased. So there are some species that are doing well, but they tend to be the sort of generalist species, species that we might see in our gardens or parks and across the general countryside. What we're losing is the diversity. So the species that we're losing, and some of these declines are huge, you know, the heath fritillary, for example, 88% decline, pearl border fritillary, 70% decline. They're enormous losses. And it's that diversity, that sort of nuance and subtlety that we're losing from our landscape.
Now, clearly, some will say that's exactly why we should deal with climate change. Not the only reason, but one of many reasons for dealing with climate change. In the absence of that change, is there anything else that can be done to try to preserve some of those species and to preserve their habitats?
Yes, absolutely. So the main reason that we're losing these habitat specialists, these butterflies that need special habitats like flower-rich grasslands or woodland glades, the main reason we're losing those over the last 50 years is the way that we humans manage the landscape. It's not about climate change for those species. It's the way that we've simplified, damaged, destroyed the habitats where they traditionally lived, out in the farmed countryside. So we do know what we need to do to help recover those species. We can do it. We just need a lot more effort, a lot more will, and a lot more resources.
Professor Richard Fox of Butterfly Conservation, thank you.
It is 25 past seven. That means it is time for the sport. Here is Carthy.
Morning. Thank you very much. Liverpool will finish the season without any silverware after they were knocked out of the Champions League by Paris Saint-Germain. PSG beat Liverpool 2-0 last night, a 4-0 win over the two legs to move into the semi-finals, alongside Atletico Madrid, who beat Barcelona 3-2 overall. Arsenal have a 1-0 lead against Sporting in their Champions League quarter-final. The second leg tonight is at Emirates Stadium, and there's commentary on 5 Live from 8 p.m. Now, all of the home nations were involved in Women's World Cup qualifiers yesterday. Let's speak to Vicky Sparks, who was at Wembley. Morning, Vicky.
Good morning.
How important was England's 1-0 win over world champion Spain at Wembley, not just in terms of qualifying for the World Cup, but also facing the top side in the world?
Quite simply, Carthy, it was crucial. Only one side goes through automatically from the League A groups. So either the reigning European champions, England, or the reigning world champion, Spain, will be heading for the playoffs. Yes, England still have to travel to Spain in June, but this victory moves them 3 points clear at the top of the group at the halfway stage. And I think the manner of it was so encouraging. The early goal from Lauren Hemp allowed England to execute that game plan of soaking up Spain pressure and hitting them on the counter-attack with a lead to hold on to. And they did so overall with a composure and a confidence that I don't think I've seen them show against Spain before. Yes, there were nervy moments, including a big save from Hannah Hampton right at the end. But whose game plan worked better by far on the night England's, without a doubt.
Yeah, they've learnt a lot, haven't they, in the last few years. And Wales had a 4-0 win over Albania. Do they look like they're in the kind of form to now perhaps reach a first World Cup?
Well, that is the dream, isn't it? After reaching their first major tournament last summer in the Euros. It was an encouraging night for Wales, but they've still got a way to go. Unlike England, Wales, along with Northern Ireland and Scotland, are in League B for these qualifiers, which means no automatic qualification spot. So they're all trying to pin down a playoff place. Now, winning the group would give Wales a more favourable playoff path, and they were knocked off top spot last night by Czechia. They're still level on points with them, though, and their home game with Czechia in June could prove decisive in terms of the group winners.
And there was late drama in Scotland's qualifier against the top seeds Belgium. That's an impressive 1-1 result for Scotland, isn't it?
Yeah, 95th minute equaliser from Kathleen McGovern, earning them a 1-1 draw at home to the top seeds, as you say, the group favourites, Belgium. It keeps Scotland top of their standings as well. And a good night for Northern Ireland too. They beat Malta 4-0 to earn their first points of this qualifying campaign.
OK, Vicky Sparks, thank you very much. A couple of other headlines for you. Tennis and the world number two, Carlos Alcaraz, won his first round match at the Barcelona Open, beating Finland's Otto Virtanen in straight sets. British number one Cam Norrie faces America's Ethan Quinn in the second round this afternoon. And British teenager Stan Moody has qualified for the World Snooker Championship for the first time a day after being hospitalised with tonsillitis. The 19-year-old becomes the youngest Brit to take part at the Crucible since a 17-year-old Judd Trump in 2007.
Cathy, thank you for that. The weather is going to be unsettled and windy today. Showery rain moving eastward through the UK. Infrequent lightning.
Going west.
Oh, I haven't finished yet. Drier by the evening.
In the west.
There you go.
Ah, crucial. Didn't want to miss that. And you won't want to miss a BBC investigation, which is coming up after the news summary in a moment's time, which reveals that legal advisers are charging some migrants thousands of pounds to help them pretend to be gay in order to avoid being deported.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4. Nick Robinson and Justin Webb. The time is exactly 7:30. Here is Alan Smith with the news.
The Chancellor Rachel Reeves is due to meet the US Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent in Washington today after criticising what she described as the folly of America entering a war with Iran without an exit plan. Speaking to the Daily Mirror, she said the conflict had led to the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, with UK families and businesses now feeling the impact. Yesterday, the International Monetary Fund predicted the economic fallout from the conflict would hit the UK harder than any other advanced economy. The US Vice President J.D. Vance says Iran's negotiators want to make a deal, but warned that mistrust between the two countries could not be solved overnight. He was speaking after President Trump suggested talks could resume in the coming days following their collapse on Sunday. A BBC investigation has found that a shadow industry of law firms and advisers is charging thousands of pounds to help migrants pretend to be gay in order to stay in the UK. Those whose visas are due to run out are being given fake cover stories for their asylum claims and are instructed in how to obtain fabricated evidence, including supporting letters and photos at LGBT events. A US state visit by the King Charles and Queen Camilla later this month won't include a meeting with Jeffrey Epstein's survivors. Palace sources say it's to avoid affecting legal action. Calls for a meeting have grown in the light of Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor's links to the sex offender. He denies any wrongdoing. A woman's health strategy for England is being unveiled today, including a new scheme branded a patient power payment. Women will be able to give feedback about their treatment, which could lead to money being allocated to areas that need improvement. And hospices in England are warning of a growing financial crisis that could force them to cut services, close beds and in some cases shut down entirely. Staff are heading to Downing Street to present the Prime Minister with a letter calling for urgent help.
Thank you, Alan. It's 29 minutes to 8 now. Tell them you're gay. Have your photograph taken at the right club. Pretend you have a same-sex partner. That's the advice being given to some migrants by legal advisers who are charging them thousands of pounds on how to make sure they will be allowed to stay in the country. It's been exposed by our political investigations correspondent, Billy Kemper. Here's his report.
Forest Gate in East London. Our undercover reporter is on his way to meet with an immigration advisor who's already told him she can help him stay in the country. Her name is Tanisha Khan,
and the first meeting is at her house.
Have you helped anyone like this before?
I have done a lot.
Did it succeed or not?
Yes, with God's grace.
How many were successful?
A lot.
Our reporter is posing as a former student who wants to stay in the UK. He's not being persecuted. He has no genuine basis to claim asylum. But Tanisha explains one specific way to remain in the country. An actor voices her words.
At the moment, there is only one route from where you can get a visa. It's on human rights. It's called gay case or same sex. You have to prove that you are an LGBTQ person.
But I am not.
That's it, you're not. There is no hope for any other visa.
Tanisha is offering help obtaining asylum, a protection that's offered when it's too dangerous for someone to live in their home country. Being homosexual and from Pakistan, where gay sex is illegal, could mean you qualify. For £2,500, Tanisha offers to provide evidence to support the fake claim.
The approach we will take is this. I will fully prepare you for the interview by compiling a comprehensive package for you, including photographs of you at clubs, various other pieces of supporting evidence, so that you are completely ready when I send you in. I'll give you a letter from someone along with which we will take a few photographs, and that person will write that they have engaged in physical sex with you.
Is that what an advisor should be doing in a case like this?
No, absolutely not. This is the very last thing an advisor should be doing.
We showed what we'd recorded to Ana Gonzalez, an immigration solicitor with more than two decades working on asylum cases.
This person is breaking the law, is committing fraud by manufacturing a claim to give to this person an oven-ready claim, so to speak.
We show Ana how Tanisha even has an answer for someone pretending to be gay who wants to bring their wife over.
Once she's here, it's easy to fabricate a lesbian case. Just bring her over, whether as a student, a tourist, or however else you like.
As a tourist as well?
Bring her however you like. Just bring her over the one time. Once she's here, we can make her a lesbian.
Well, you think you've seen it all, and then you see something like this. And it's infuriating to practitioners like me. People like that is just really making things harder for the legitimate asylum seekers and refugees out there.
Turn to me a little bit. Yeah, good, good. Yeah. Okay.
We're preparing our undercover reporter for another meeting at Tanisha's office in Ilford. She tells him she has her own LGBT group she wants him to get involved with, even though she knows he's not really gay.
I'll make you a member of our organisation.
What organisation?
Worcester organisation.
Worcester?
Worcester LGBT Asylum Seekers Group. This meeting is essential because you are required to provide evidence to the Home Office demonstrating that if you are gay, you are indeed affiliated with a gay organisation. We can claim that you have actually been associated with us all along.
150, 10, 20, 30, 40.
The reporter makes a down payment of £150 to become a client. Later, he's invited to attend his first meeting. Not in Worcester, as it turns out, but at a busy community centre in East London.
Our reporter is in there. The meeting is going on right now. And every time we've driven past, there's more and more people going in. It's clearly absolutely packed in there. And we know from Tanisha that a lot of them, like our reporter, are just pretending to be gay.
He strikes up conversation with one of those attending, who introduces himself as Zeeshan.
There's quite a lot of people.
There are 200 plus people. Definitely 200 plus people.
Are they all gay?
Yes, everyone's gay.
I'm not gay.
Not even 1% are gay. Not even 0.01% are gay.
One after another, the migrants tell our undercover reporter that many of those attending are not genuine members of an LGBT group. Actors are voicing their words.
Most of the people here aren't gay.
When you go for your interview, you have to be shameless.
Are you actually gay?
We shouldn't talk like this here.
I'm thinking that others might think that I'm gay.
Nobody is gay here.
Shall I get in? Or shall I keep walking?
Back in the car, our reporter explains more about what's been happening inside.
They've come here from South Wales, Coventry, Birmingham.
For tonight?
Yeah, for tonight. And they're going back tonight after the
event. Just to go to that meeting?
Just for the event.
So this isn't just people in London, this is people from all over the country?
Yep.
And they're all coming to this meeting in Beckton?
Yep.
tonight get proof that they're there.
Yep.
To then give it to the Home Office and say, oh, I'm genuine.
Tanisha Khan told us she denies all wrongdoing and said there'd been communication difficulties because she's not a fluent Urdu speaker. Worcester LGBT told us they were investigating her, but said they do not create, encourage or support fabricated evidence in asylum claims. The Home Office said anyone found trying to exploit the system will face the full force of the law.
That was Billy Kemba's exclusive report. And incidentally, there'll be another part of his investigation on the programme tomorrow as he reveals other ways that people try to play the system in order to be given permission to stay in the UK. Well, let's turn to Joe White now, a member of the Home Affairs Select Committee, Labour MP, chair of what's called the Red Wall Caucus, to react to what she's heard. I suspect the answer is shock but not surprise, Joe White. Is that right?
Exactly, exactly. I think where thousands of people, and there's over 100,000 asylum claims right now, where those numbers of people are being processed, there will always be opportunities for fraud and criminal activity. And it's what's known as fixer networks, and they're operating in plain sight. And it's absolutely essential that the government cracks down on them. Evidence like this, I hope, will go straight to the police, and the police will begin their activity and break it apart.
As with lots of illegal activity, it's impossible to put a scale on this. But what our research shows is that what you can say is that certain nationalities have seen very large increases in the number of people claiming that they are gay in their asylum claims, particularly amongst Pakistanis, for example. Is there a way in which there can be a wider investigation of this, not just a journalist digging in and having to go undercover to reveal it?
What I welcome is Shabana Mahmood's announcement last month that student visas will be cancelled immediately and prevented, that people from Cameroon, Myanmar, Sudan and Afghanistan will no longer be able to come here on student visas because of the exploitation. And I would like to see Pakistan added to that list. I so certainly hope it will do so very, very quickly. I'm on the Home Affairs Select Committee. This is certainly questions I will be asking the Immigration Minister when he's next in front of us, because understanding the extent of it is absolutely essential.
There's one other country that's noted in the figures that 49% of asylum applications from Ugandan nationals had an element of, as the way it's put, a claim about being lesbian or gay or bisexual in those claims. The government said that it would crack down on this sort of bogus advice, illegal advice. Are the fines that are available, £15,000, really enough to deal with the amount of money that can be made through these bogus claims?
No, it's not. It's £65,000 fine for somebody who's employing somebody illegally. And perhaps it should be put at similar levels to that, and 5 years imprisonment for people who are employing people illegally. So, you know, in order to prevent these activities, the penalties have to be a lot tougher. And certainly I will be raising that with Shabana Mahmood, the Home Secretary.
Do you think the Labour Party, your colleagues in Parliament, are willing to see that, though? Because as the Home Secretary has announced a series of crackdowns on immigration, there's been resistance from amongst your ranks, from people saying that's not what Labour got into power to do.
I'd certainly challenge that. And certainly on illegal immigration, I think we as a party are united. It has to stop. We have to stop those boats, and we have to crack down where there's fraudulent and criminal activity. I think we're united, absolutely united in doing that.
Joe White, member of the Home Affairs Select Committee, thanks for joining us.
And that brings us to 19 minutes to 8. In her victim impact statement, Jenny Stancombe, mother of 7-year-old Elsie Dot Stancombe, said of the Southport killer, Axel Rudikubana, his actions have left us with a lifetime of grief, a lifetime of grief that the inquiry report on Monday made clear could have been prevented. The inquiry chairman, Sir Adrian Fulford, blaming the various authorities who'd failed to act, but also saying that if the parents had reported their true level of knowledge to the authorities before the attack, the killer would undoubtedly have been taken into care or held in custody. We talked yesterday to Chris Walker, the lawyer who represents the families of the three girls who were murdered, Alice, Elsie and Bibi.
There should be individual criminal accountability for the parents. I accept that the law and the legal process which we currently have It makes that very difficult. And I know one of the recommendations within the report is to change that, which is pleasing.
Merseyside police have said they've been looking into prosecuting the parents, but there's currently no legal duty for bystanders and or parents to warn or to report criminality. They maintain that line in the wake of a case in the United States, though, where two parents, Jennifer and James Crumbly, are in jail after being convicted in a legal first, as I've been hearing from Dylan Taxman, who is a professor of law at Baylor University.
James and Jennifer Crumbly's son, Ethan Crumbly, committed the Oxford high school shooting in Michigan. Their case, wherein they were charged and convicted of involuntary manslaughter, so a substantive homicide offense, essentially they were convicted of committing a homicide themselves. They were the first parents in American history to be convicted of a substantive homicide offense following their child perpetrating a school shooting.
From what you know of the Axel Rudikubana case, does it seem to you that there are similarities?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are. So I've identified sort of the three prongs that parents typically need to satisfy in order to face criminal liability or at least substantive homicide liability for their children's violent acts as, number one, sort of failing to treat an obvious mental health crisis. From what I've read of the report, seems like there's some agency failure as well, perhaps not just the father, but certainly ineffective steps when it comes to treating what was an obvious sort of mental health crisis, failure to address violent and homicidal ideations. Here again, seems to be present, and then provision or allowing accessibility to the means of committing the harm. In the United States, typically we're talking about firearms, but my understanding is that essentially he accepted delivery of a series of knives, a series of weapons that were eventually used to perpetrate the killings.
If he had done those things in the United States, you think he would be prosecuted, or the parents would be prosecuted?
I think it's quite possible. I don't see quite as much detail as I did in the Crumbly case and the Colin Gray case. I mean, in the Crumbly case, I think the key thing is at some point they see at the school a journal that shows the gun they've purchased him and a series of sort of violent acts with that gun. In the Colin Gray case, the case out of Georgia that just resulted in a parental homicide conviction, police sort of traced online comments about committing a school shooting. The son had a shrine in his room, which the father knew about, to another sort of mass shooter. All of those are pretty striking indications of violent tendencies. But I think a lot of that same stuff is present here. I mean, from what I read in the report, it's like, I think the father actually knew that he was planning to go and commit a stabbing or an arson at his school. So I think a lot of those criteria exist in this case.
Dylan Taxman, Professor of Law at Baylor University. Thank you very much.
It is now 14 minutes to six, and it is time for Thought for the Day. But let me just tell you what's coming up before that. We'll discuss how the King plans to tread the diplomatic tightrope during his state visit to the US following recent tensions between President Trump and Sir Keir Starmer. Now, the speaker on Thought for the Day this morning is Professor Tina Beattie, writer and Catholic theologian.
Good morning. They say that religion and politics don't mix, but it's impossible to separate the two when the Pope and the American President have gone head-to-head over the war in Iran. In a social media post, President Trump accused Pope Leo of being weak and advised that he should focus on being a great pope, not a politician. Pope Leo responded by insisting that he's not a politician, but that the message of the gospel, "Blessed are the peacemakers," is a message that the world needs to hear today. This confrontation has catapulted the Pope onto the front pages of the world's media. But he's not the first modern pope to speak out against war. in 2003, when then Cardinal Ratzinger, later Pope Benedict XVI, was asked to comment on the Iraq war, he said that there were not sufficient reasons to unleash a war against Iraq. He went on to ask if it is still licit to admit the very existence of a just war. St. Augustine gave a Christian interpretation to the idea of the just war in the early 5th century. He argued that terrible though war always is, it's sometimes necessary to defend the innocent and preserve peace. However, it must seek the future well-being of the enemy and be free from the lust for power or desire to dominate. These ideas were developed by St. Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century, and they continued to shape Western politics and international law long after Christianity ceased to be a major political influence. However ineffectual it might sometimes have become in the heat of battle, just war theory provided a restraining influence on the waging of war, especially with regard to the need to avoid the intentional targeting of non-combatants. Today, the nature of modern weapons and the bombing of densely populated areas means that civilian casualties, including children, usually far outnumber military deaths. This is the context in which the Catholic Church's opposition to war must be interpreted. Pope Leo is continuing a tradition set by all modern popes since the 1960s. In his Palm Sunday address, he quoted the prophet Isaiah when he said that Jesus does not listen to the prayers of those who wage war, but rejects them, saying, "Even though you make many prayers, I will not listen. Your hands are full of blood." This is religious language, but it holds politicians accountable for shedding innocent blood. How could it do otherwise when Christians worship a crucified God?
That was Thought for the Day with Professor Tina Beattie. It's now 11 minutes to 8.
The King and the Queen go to the United States at the end of the month for a visit that is not without some risks. And it's not just the Iran war that looms over it. Jeffrey Epstein does as well, and his close relationship with the former Prince Andrew, who, although he says he did nothing wrong, is not willing, it seems, to testify in the United States to Congress or indeed to anyone else. More details of the itinerary were released by Buckingham Palace just last night, and they do not include a meeting with the Epstein victims. One of the survivors of his abuse, Lisa Phillips, talked to us on Friday about her hopes that she would get to meet the King and the Queen.
We have already sent letters to him, and we've already been requesting meetings with him. I'm not quite sure if it's going to happen, but it may happen with Camilla. She's always been supportive of the survivors, and she's taken a stand for us. So I think she would be the more likely person to meet with us. So, I mean, we're hopeful that maybe she will.
But it seems that meeting is not going to take place. That was Lisa Phillips. The Democratic Congressman Ro Khanna, who has been very much a backer of the victims, has added his voice to those calling for a meeting. The modern monarchy, he says, is going to be a force for public good. It could be a defining moment for the monarchy to keep it relevant to my generation in the 21st century. Let us talk to Roy Nicker, the royal editor at The Times, and to Sir Peter Westmacott, who's also on the line, former UK ambassador to the US. Morning to you both. And Roy, first of all, I mean, it was unlikely, wasn't it, that they were going to have this meeting. What is the reason the palace gives for not having it?
Well, good morning. I mean, officially, the line from Buckingham Palace is that they don't want to risk anything emerging from any potential meetings with survivors that could potentially jeopardise any potential criminal investigation that's ongoing here or police action. I think what was interesting that came out of our briefing with the palace and the Foreign Office yesterday was that the Queen will, throughout the programme on several occasions, make a point of meeting with victims of sexual abuse and domestic violence. Of course, that has underpinned a lot of her charitable work for a very long time. But I know, you know, that won't stop calls when we're out in Washington from survivors, from the likes of Congressman Ro Khanna, still saying, you know, if the monarchy wants to show it really does understand victims, and we've had statements from the King and Queen saying that, it would meet with them.
There is also, I suppose, the question of what they knew previously about the friendship that Andrew had with Jeffrey Epstein, and whether they, as a royal family, never mind Andrew, but actually as a royal family, need to be more open about it.
I think those questions, if and when they come, are more likely to come further down the line in a police investigation as it continues into Andrew Mountbatten Windsor and indeed Peter Mandelson, rather than, I think, the palace. But as you can imagine, the palace is so closely trying to sort of safeguard any potential embarrassment or fallout on this. They would want to avoid those kind of questions coming out of meetings, which is exactly why they say that, you know, that the King and Queen can't have those meetings in private in case it risks any potential investigation.
And then on the politics of it, Sir Peter, we hear, don't we? We were told last night that he's going to have tea, or the royal couple are going to have tea with President Trump, and there'll be various things behind the scenes, but very much behind the scenes.
Good morning, Justin. Yes, that's right. There's going to be quite a lot of contact. There's the tea, there's going to be the state banquet, and there are two important speeches that the King will be giving, one at the banquet and one to the joint houses of Congress, which is an unusual compliment to him. I think the late Queen did that just once. So since the war, it's only the second time, I think, that is happening. So, lots going on, private meetings, but also a lot of public events celebrating the relationship between what the palace calls the two nations and the two peoples.
And yet the relationship between the two governments at the moment seems pretty poor. And when they talk about these challenges that we all face, that some of the challenges, as Rachel Rees has been making clear overnight, the British side believe these challenges have been put in place by the Americans. I just wonder the extent to which behind the scenes, at least privately, do these things just not come up? How does that work?
Well, quite clearly, this presidency, which at times can look like a kind of performative clown show, it's done a lot of damage to international interest, to peace, to prosperity. Rachel Reeves has underlined the damage to the British economy of what's been going on. This is government business, primarily. Behind the scenes, of course, there's an opportunity for private conversations between the two heads of state. That is, you know, we've got the King, we've got the President. The King does not have executive responsibility, the President does. But these are not business-to-business, government-to-government conversations with records of meetings that are sent around government where government business is transacted. There is, however, opportunity for, you know, very clear private conversation where the King can say what he thinks, and the President will no doubt say what he thinks too. So it rather depends on, I suppose, the chemistry and on the desire of the individuals to address it.
And the chemistry
is extremely well informed. And so, and I'd be very surprised if a lot of these issues you're talking about did not come up in private.
The chemistry from the Trump perspective is quite interesting. Roy, I don't know if you saw overnight, he's been talking to Sky News. It was one of these phone calls that he has kind of randomly. He's been saying things that I think probably will assuage the concerns of the palace about King Charles. He's a great gentleman, a friend of mine, a fantastic person. And when he's asked if the strained relationship could overshadow the visit, no, not at all. I've known the King for a long time. He's not involved in that process.
And yes, I've seen those comments from the call. And yet just last week he was saying the King would have backed me over Iran. You can imagine how that went down at the palace. The palace will absolutely, you know, this is the soft power that the palace and the government know they can deploy. It's why they're sending the King and Queen, because, you know, like him or loathe him, Donald Trump is mildly obsessed with our royal family and loves having the King and Queen there. And I think, to Peter's point earlier about this is, you know, business and government business, but those points that Charles will make in private to Trump, you'll remember when Donald Trump came out and said that, you know, UK forces did not go to the front line in Afghanistan. The King made it very clear in private channels in a message to the White House. He thought that was a pretty appalling thing to say. And Donald Trump came out and apologised. So there is huge soft power that the King can deploy, and probably even more effectively behind closed doors.
And they'll be very keen to make sure, Sir Peter, it is behind closed doors. In other words, there's no opportunity for some sort of ambush to take place, or just for something. You think of Trump recently, didn't he talk to the Japanese Prime Minister about Pearl Harbor? And you could see that the anguish in her face when he mentioned it. They look as if from the itinerary, don't they? They've avoided that completely.
I don't think there'll be conversations about the War of 1812 or the American Revolutionary War.
Actually, they like talking about 1812. It's far enough away for it to be fine.
Well, we don't so much. But I think the photographs will be stills, Justin. There will not be video and opportunities for ambush, is my prediction.
Roy, you agree?
I do. It's very carefully managed. You know, the whole thing is being tightly controlled. There will be some sort of face-to-face meetings and you know, time to engage with the public when they get to Virginia. But everything in Washington is absolutely choreographed to avoid any of that.
That's interesting, actually, when it comes to the public. And obviously the risk, if it is a risk, of questions being thrown and all the rest of it, and particularly, I suppose, going back to Epstein, there's not much of it, is there? But there is, you're saying, a bit.
There is, particularly in Virginia. And to be honest, Justin, that is now, I think, baked into royal engagements. We are now at a stage with the investigation ongoing into Andrew that the king, the queen and other members of the royal family kind of expect those questions to be called out by either members of the public or the press. So, you know, I suspect that will happen. It won't faze them. But the itinerary, as you say, has definitely been carefully managed to avoid that. But there is, when they get to Virginia, there is time with the public. So we'll see what happens there.
Roy Necker and Sir Peter Westmacott, thank you both.
And here is Nuala with details of this morning's Women's Hour, which we've already been talking about on the programme.
Yes, thank you. We will have the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, in the Women's Hour studio with me from 10. He's going to be talking about the renewed Women's Health Strategy for England that has just been announced, in which he states that the NHS is failing women and girls on even the most basic measures of healthcare. So what is the government's plan to change a culture of medical misogyny, to cut diagnosis times and to bring down those waiting lists for women? The Health Secretary will be taking questions from our listeners. So email them via the Women's Hour website, or you can text me at 84844.
Thank you for that. Let us turn to the weather. It comes this morning from Thomas Schaffernacher. Good morning again, Thomas.
Good morning, Justin. Very cloudy across the UK right now, but it's quite mild. Temperatures are around 10 or 11 Celsius. We are expecting some rain today. It has already been raining across parts of Scotland, in Northern Ireland, and the rain is just starting to reach the southwest of England and Wales too. And I think today, different parts of the country will get the rain at different times. So broadly speaking, first half of the day, the rain will continue in Scotland and many western parts of the country, and then the second half of the day that rain will transfer further east. So it means that east of the Pennines and across Lincolnshire, East Anglia and the southeast, well, the rain here shouldn't reach you until much later on in the afternoon. And then later in the day, we are actually expecting some sunny spells to develop across many western areas of the UK, but showers will be never too far away, carried on quite a brisk Atlantic wind. Now, today's temperatures will range from 13 Celsius in Belfast to about 16 in Manchester, and in London we can expect 18 degrees. Tonight, showers in the north of the country, clear spells in the south, not particularly cold, 6 to 8 Celsius. And then tomorrow, again, it's a mixture of bright spells and also some showers, and that's how it's going to stay the rest of the week.
Thank you, Tom. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Nick Robinson.
It's 8 o'clock on Wednesday, the 15th of April. The headlines this morning. The Chancellor, who's in Washington, has said she's angry and frustrated at President Trump's decision to go to war with Iran without a clear exit plan. We'll be talking to the Chief Secretary to the Treasury, James Murray, after the news. A BBC investigation has found that some legal advisers are charging thousands of pounds to help migrants pretend to be gay in order to claim asylum and stay in the UK. And work is beginning on a £7 million operation to clear a mountain of illegal waste in Oxfordshire.
Also coming up in the next hour, we'll hear from the Emmy Award-winning filmmaker behind a new documentary which explores the culture war on American university campuses and the fear and loathing that has spilt out into the wider society.
I'm not talking about hate speech. I'm not talking about free speech in the kind of First Amendment American way. I'm talking about our ability to speak freely about ideas and issues without fear of cancellation.
And are Lancastrians in danger of losing their regional burr, the arth that make them so special, the one that's so well displayed by the House of Commons Speaker Lindsay Hoyle?
I'm told that I'm the first ever Lancastrian speaker, so we're going to make the most of this. That's what it's all about. It's about Lancashire, making the voice of Lancashire here in London.
Fellow Lancastrian Jane Horrocks will join us before 9 o'clock. That's all after the BBC News, read for us this morning by Alan Smith.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, will hold talks with US Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent in Washington today after saying she's very frustrated and angry that the US went to war with Iran without an exit plan. In an interview with the Daily Mirror, Ms. Reeves criticised what she called the folly of President Trump's decision. She said that, as a result, the vital Strait of Hormuz waterway was now blocked and families and businesses in the UK were feeling the impact. Yesterday, the International Monetary Fund predicted the economic fallout from the conflict would hit the UK harder than any other advanced economy. From the IMF's meeting in Washington, here's our economics editor, Faisal Islam.
Among the world's finance ministers and central bankers gathered here at the IMF, there is concern that another geopolitical crisis has hampered economic recovery and threatened household living standards. The Chancellor's public frustration and anger at the economic impact of the war might be tested at her bilateral meeting with her US counterpart, Scott Bessent, later today. He told the BBC yesterday the current disruptions were worth it to avoid the economic impact of a nuclear strike on London. The French finance minister, Roland Lescure, told the BBC that any resolution was still a way off.
I think there's a willingness to keep on talking, but at the end of the day, there's no escaping. The Strait of Hormuz is the economic knot of this crisis. And if we don't open it peacefully and lastly, and that's going to take a while, then we're going to keep on missing 12 million barrels a day for a long time.
On Friday, the UK and France will host an international conference on reopening the Strait of Hormuz, though only after a peace deal is agreed. Market oil prices had dipped yesterday on the hope of further peace talks, but the concern now is about the physical supplies of gas, diesel, fertiliser products and helium that were due to have been delivered around now but are still trapped in the Gulf.
The head of the employers group, the Confederation of British Industry, Ray Newton-Smith, told us the war had shone a light on high energy costs in the UK.
There are things that the government can do. They're already consulting at the moment through our industrial strategy on a measure to reduce those high energy costs for industry. That's not set to come into place until 2027. We should bring that forward and implement that now so that we can reduce some of those high energy costs for our energy intensive industries.
The US Vice President J.D. Vance has said that Iran's negotiators want to make a deal, but mistrust between the nations cannot be solved overnight. He was speaking after President Trump suggested that the talks with Iran could restart soon after they collapsed on Sunday. Here's our North America correspondent Peter Bowes.
Speaking before an audience of the conservative campus network Turning Point USA, J.D. Vance said he felt very good about where the US stood with Iran. He acknowledged that mistrust between the two countries spanning several decades could not be overcome overnight, but he believed the Iranian negotiators wanted to make a deal. He reiterated that it was the president's policy that Iran could not have a nuclear weapon and that negotiations to that end were taking place. Speaking to the New York Post yesterday, Mr. Trump said peace talks could be happening over the next 2 days.
The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency says there's been a very serious increase in North Korea's ability to produce nuclear weapons. Speaking at a news conference in Seoul, Rafael Grossi said activity had been intensifying at a key nuclear site and it's likely Pyongyang would be capable of producing a few dozen warheads. A BBC investigation has revealed a shadow industry of legal advisers charging thousands of pounds to help migrants pretend to be gay in order to stay in the country. Those whose visas are due to run out are being given fake cover stories for their asylum claims and are instructed on how to obtain fabricated evidence, including supporting letters and photos at LGBT events. Our politics investigations correspondent Billy Kemba reports.
The UK's asylum process offers protection to people who can't return to their home countries because they would be in danger. But our investigation reveals how some advisers are extracting fees from international students and workers who want to stay in the country. One adviser, Tanisha Khan, told a BBC undercover reporter his only hope was to claim asylum by pretending to be gay. She told the reporter to go to an East London event for gay asylum seekers to help with his application. We secretly filmed a succession of men there, saying many attending weren't genuinely gay. Tanisha Khan denied all wrongdoing and said there'd been communication difficulties because she wasn't a fluent Urdu speaker. The Home Office said anyone found trying to exploit the system would face the full force of the law.
The Competition and Markets Authority has fined two driving schools owned by the AA more than £4 million for what's known as drip pricing. The CMA said the firms had not included a mandatory £3 booking fee in their upfront prices. The AA driving school and BSM driving school have been ordered by the watchdog to issue refunds to more than 80,000 customers. A women's health strategy for England is being unveiled today, including a new scheme branded a patient power payment. Women will be able to give feedback about their treatment, which could lead to money being allocated to areas that need improvement. The strategy, first published by the Conservative government in 2022, has now been updated by Labour. Our health editor Hugh Pym reports.
The latest version of the plan comes against a backdrop of criticism that women's voices are often ignored and marginalised by the NHS. Gynaecology has been selected for the first trial of a scheme which will allocate funding to areas identified as inadequate by patients. A new standard of care will be introduced to ensure women are offered appropriate pain relief for invasive gynaecological procedures. BBC analysis shows that there was a 98% increase in this waiting list over the last 6 years, compared with 58% for other conditions. The Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists has welcomed the strategy, but says that despite the government's commitments on waiting lists, the picture for women remains deeply concerning.
Hospices in England are warning of a growing financial crisis that could force them to cut services, close beds and in some cases shut down entirely. Staff from across England are heading to Downing Street to present the Prime Minister with a letter calling for urgent help, as Nomia Iqbal reports.
Hospices say they're being pushed towards a financial cliff edge as rising costs continue to outstrip government funding. Hospice UK says staff costs alone are expected to increase from £1.2 billion in 2024 to more than £1.4 billion by 2026. Yet on average, only around 40% of hospice care is funded by the state, leaving charitable donations to make up the gaps. Last year, the government announced funding of more than £100 million for over 2 years, but providers say it's already run out.
Work is beginning on a six-month operation to clear thousands of tonnes of waste illegally dumped along a field at Kidlington in Oxfordshire. It'll cost £7.3 million to remove the rubbish at the site, which is the first of four areas earmarked for clearance at taxpayers' expense. Here's our Rural Affairs correspondent Jenny Kumar.
The huge 20,000-tonne site at Kidlington is estimated to cover an area larger than Wembley Stadium. It lies in between the A34 and the River Charwell, which it was feared it could pollute. The Environment Agency was criticised for not acting fast enough after it first received reports from the public of dumping in June last year. 4 months later, a court order was issued in October, restricting access to the site. Normally, it's the landowner's responsibility to clear waste dumped on their land. But in December last year, the agency announced it had taken the exceptional decision to clean up the site because of its fire risks. Four arrests have been made as part of a criminal investigation into the dump.
Research suggests that many of the UK's butterfly species are facing steep declines because of climate change, habitat loss and pollution. Data from the UK Butterfly Monitoring Scheme suggests that while warmer weather has helped some native species to flourish, many of our most distinctive varieties are struggling to survive. The head of science at the charity Butterfly Conservation, Professor Richard Fox, told us some of the losses have been dramatic.
There are some species that are doing well, but they tend to be the sort of generalist species, species that we might see in our gardens or parks. What we're losing is the diversity. So the species that we're losing, and some of these declines are huge, you know, the Heath fritillary, for example, 88% decline. And it's that diversity, that sort of nuance and subtlety that we're losing from our landscape.
That was Professor Richard Cox from Butterfly Conservation.
Thank you, Alan. It is 8:10. Growth will be cut here more than in any other wealthy country. Inflation will be higher than any other wealthy country. Those are the grim forecasts contained in the latest IMF Global Economic Review. Now, it is just a forecast, and the IMF forecast, like any other forecast, may turn out to be wrong. But what underlies it are undeniable facts. The IMF's economists explain that the reason they believe the UK will be the hardest hit of any major economy is because we're a net importer of energy, and the cost of borrowing in this country to service our country's debts is higher than other G7 countries. The Chancellor is beginning to sound like she's had a premonition of what might be coming, Rachel Reeves told The Mirror as she attends that IMF conference in Washington, D.C., that it was folly for Donald Trump
to launch a war with no exit plan. In a moment, we'll talk to her deputy, the man in charge of public spending in this country, the Chief Secretary to the Treasury, James Murray. First, though, let's hear what this means for a business. Ed Pitt, Managing Director of KGD Industrial Services Limited in Hereford. Morning to you, Mr. Pitt.
Good morning, Nick.
Tell us about your business, what you do and how it's being impacted by this war.
We're a manufacturing fabrication, design fabrication for fluid handling systems, employing about 140 people with a lot of apprentices and training programs, trying to get the skill levels to where we want it.
And your bills are going up for energy, are they?
Yeah, we use about £250,000 worth of electricity and gas every year. And we run about 20 company vehicles. So we've got instant sort of diesel impacts at the moment, with fuel or electricity contracts running out in the autumn, which who knows what those prices are going to be.
And do you have a sense of what impact it'll have on your bottom line?
Well, it's just on top of all the other things that we seem to be having now. We've got NI, we've had huge minimum rate rises, particularly with our apprentices. We've got all of the other rates increases, the apprentice levies for those levy payers, that has increased eightfold. We've gone from 5,000 to 43,000 just for our training every year of apprentices.
So are you saying that that combination of extra tax costs, minimum wage costs, alongside extra energy costs is making it a real struggle for your business?
It was a struggle before. We are the most expensive energy in the world. We have some of the best natural resources, but we refuse to use them when we want to buy in from everywhere else. It's just unsustainable. The Americans are going to bring AI here. Well, they're not, because the energy is too expensive.
Ed Pitt, Managing Director of KGD. Thank you for your time, Mr. Pitt. We want to turn, if we could, because time is limited, to the Chief Secretary to the Treasury, James Murray. Morning to you, Mr. Murray. Have we got James Murray in Westminster?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Okay, now. Good. Sorry, forgive me. We couldn't before, but we can hear you now. Morning, and thanks for joining us from Westminster.
Thank you.
We'll come to Mr. Pitt's points in a second, but let's start with the overview, if we could. Your boss is at the IMF in Washington, saying she's frustrated and angry. We can't talk to her, but we're delighted to talk to you. Why are you in the Treasury so frustrated and angry?
Well, look, as Rachel said, we're really frustrated and angry because the conflict in the Middle East has been begun without a clear plan for exiting it and without a clear strategy of what it sets out to achieve. And I think what makes us most frustrated and angry is the impact that it's having on people here in Britain. Because if you think about the spring forecast that the Chancellor gave just around the time that the conflict in Iran was beginning, you know, it was showing inflation coming down, interest rates and mortgage rates coming down, borrowing coming down. You know, it showed that we had the right economic plan. Now, that's put us in a better position to weather what's coming our way as a result of the conflict in the Middle East.
So why does the IMF say we'll be worse hit than any other economy if we're in a better position?
Yeah, well, it really underlines the fact that even though it's not our war, it's going to have an impact on our economy.
And no, forgive me, my question was why are we worse hit than other countries? Well, and the IMF is clear we will be worse hit than other countries.
As you were saying earlier, you know, one of the factors of our economy is our dependence on energy from overseas. We haven't taken advantage of the energy independence opportunities that we have in the UK. I think Mr. Pitt referred to that as well in his contribution, because if we can get energy independence, if we can increase our energy security by investing more in nuclear energy, wind power, solar power, as we've been doing since we took office in 2024, that protects us from future shocks.
There is, of course, another way of taking advantage of our energy independence. It's called the gas and oil in the North Sea. Now, with the IMF making clear that energy costs are a principal reason for the more serious hit to the UK economy, isn't it time ministers made their minds up about allowing, for example, Jackdaw, the gas field off the North Sea, to be exploited
to the full as soon as possible?
Well, I'm very clear that oil and gas in the north, from the North Sea will continue to play a really important part
in our
energy
mix. Yeah, but that is a phrase on a press release. What's the answer to the question? When will ministers decide whether Jackdaw, and forgive me if I'm sounding slightly impatient, I've been asking this question for months, and you've just heard a businessman, in effect, ask it, when will ministers tell us the decision about using the existing gas and oil in the North Sea?
Yeah, well, we've already said, Nick, that we want to see tiebacks invested in, which is where new production is linked to existing fields. But I think...
What's the answer to the question about Jackdaw?
Well, that's a decision that the Energy Secretary will make.
But I'm asking you when he'll make it.
But, Nick, can I set out...
No, can you answer the question? Well, when will the government tell us... It's not an unreasonable question. I'm not being rude. I'm asking you a question. When will the government tell us when it will allow the gas in the North Sea, which you seem to imply is consistent with your climate change policy, to be exploited? When will we know?
Well, Nick, you're talking about two specific decisions for which the decision and the date at which that decision will be taken is a matter for the Energy Secretary. I'm talking about our broader policy about continuing to use oil and gas from the North Sea. But I think
Has the Treasury told Mr. Miliband what you want to happen?
Nick, there's an important point behind your question, which I need to challenge, because you're implying that if we increase production from the North Sea, that will have an impact on oil and gas prices. And as we know, oil and gas prices are set internationally. So if we did... Oil is, but gas is not always, is it,
Mr. Murray? And in fact, I'm just merely quoting what you heard a businessman say, what the IMF said, that we rely on imports. We heard the CBI boss on the programme earlier today saying that even if it didn't have any impact on prices, it would increase the tax take available for the Treasury, which might allow you to subsidise energy costs for intensive users like the one that we just heard from.
Well, the point around tax take and jobs is well made and a really important one. And as well as oil and gas in the North Sea playing an important part in our energy mix, you know, you're right to say that will generate tax revenue and, of course, it will support jobs. But I don't want to lose the important point here, which is that, you know, we need to continue benefiting from oil and gas, but we also need to keep going at energy independence through our investment in nuclear, wind and solar, which we've been doing since we won the election.
As I pointed out, that is one definition of energy independence. Another is to use oil and gas.
We're doing both. We're making sure that through this transition, we are continuing to have production from oil and gas. I've mentioned the tiebacks, which is where new production is linked to existing oil fields. And that's alongside the investment in homegrown energy sources like nuclear, wind and solar.
OK, let's turn on to what you're responsible for. The job Chief Secretary of the Treasury means, as I said in the introduction, you're the man in charge of public spending. Are you now having to look again, as chancellors, as chief secretaries often do after a major crisis, look again at the numbers, reconsider the priorities in order to come back to us with fresh proposals?
We set out at the last spending review what our plans are to invest in public services, in defence, in everything that the government does. Those plans were taken in a way which is consistent with our fiscal rules.
But are you looking at them again?
Well, look, the plans, we stick by them. Obviously, the Chancellor built in extra headroom into the economic forecast as a result of decisions that we took. But we took that decision, the Chancellor took that decision to increase the headroom above £20 billion in the forecast in order to make sure we were better protected from shocks come our way.
Let me tell you one reason you might want to look at them again. It's because of the comments of the man that the Prime Minister asked to review defence policy in this country, the former NATO Secretary General Lord Robertson. If you've not heard his speech, here's a little clip of what he had to say.
There's a corrosive complacency today in Britain's political leadership. Lip service is paid to the risks, the threats, the bright red signals of danger. But even the promised national conversation about defence can't be started. The cold reality of today's dangerous world is that we cannot defend Britain with an ever-expanding welfare budget.
That's Lord Robertson, and he blames you guys in the Treasury. He says you're to blame for not giving defence the increase it needs. He, in fact, to quote him directly, blamed non-military experts in the Treasury and accused you of vandalism.
Well, look, I've got a lot of respect for Lord Robertson, but I couldn't disagree with him more, because if you look at the decisions that the Chancellor has taken with the Prime Minister, we've taken decisions to increase defence spending to record levels, the fastest, the biggest sustained increase since the Cold War.
It's only the biggest and the fastest because it was at a historic low. It's very easy to increase spending fast when something's at a historic low.
Well, I'm not going to deny the fact the previous government hollowed out our armed forces, but if you think about the manifesto that we went into the election with, we said that we would set out a path to 2.5% of GDP being spent on defence in this parliament. We are going to hit 2.6% next April as a result of decisions that we've taken.
Mr. Murray, which is what really matters when you have a war like this. There are other things that matter too. How many ships were we able to send to the Middle East as a result of your long and sustained increase in defence spending?
Well, so all of the sustained increase in defence spending, the details of that will be in the Defence Investment Plan, which we're going to publish. We're going to publish that as soon as possible because we need to get it right. And so we'll publish that as soon as possible.
I'm sorry to keep pointing these things out, but you've been using that phrase for weeks, for months. We'll do it as soon as possible. When?
Yeah, but Nick, the reason why we're spending time to get it right is because it is a blueprint for the next 10 years.
That's one way of putting it here. The real reason is because you guys in the Treasury are saying to the Ministry of Defence, you can't have the money you want. We're not giving it to you.
Nick, I've just been setting out the decisions that the Chancellor's taken about increasing defence investment to record levels, about increasing that investment in our readiness. But let me make this one other point, Nick, which is that whilst these really important conversations are happening about getting the Defence Investment Plan right, we are not sitting on our hands. You know, we are already investing in our military capability. We've agreed £1 billion to be invested in new helicopters, £9 billion in Rolls-Royce nuclear reactors for submarines, the new Atlantic Bastion scheme, which will make sure we can hunt down enemy submarines, £1.5 million in munitions, you know, the work on production of intercept drones. So there's a huge amount which is going on already, around 1,000 contracts since the election. All of that is happening whilst we finalise this really important plan for the next 10 years.
A final thought for you, if we could. I listed the conclusions of the IMF in the introduction. Growth cut more than any other wealthy country. Inflation higher than any other wealthy country. Borrowing costs higher than any other wealthy country. Labour isn't working, Minister, is it?
No, let me tell you something else, Nick, because if you look at those figures from the IMF, it shows that over the next 2 years, we are the fastest growing European country in the G7. And what the current crisis underscores for me is that we have the right economic plan to mean that we are best placed to weather what is coming our way. Now, we did not choose this war. This war is not one that we chose to be involved in. We said no to getting involved with it, but we are having an impact as a result of it. But that is why it's so important that we continue to promote energy independence and to keep to our tough fiscal rules, which will put us in a better position in the future.
James Murray, Chief Secretary of the Treasury, thank you for coming on.
23 minutes past eight is the time. If you use a chatbot to give you health advice, you are not alone, but you might want to think again. The journal BMJ Open says 5 popular chatbots provide information that is, in their words, inaccurate and incomplete. Dr. Jess Harvey is on the line, a GP in Shropshire, and Aldo Feisler as well, who's Professor of AI and Neuroscience at Imperial College London and Director for the Centre, Centre AI for Healthcare. Good morning to you both. Dr. Harvey, first of all, what's your experience of this with patients? When they come to see you, have they already looked up what they think they've got?
Oh, yeah, thanks for having me on. Listen, I think, we know what we really want is our patients to feel they are empowered in terms of their health and to be able to educate themselves and learn about ways to, you know, optimise their health, reduce their risks. I think the issues in terms of using AI, I'm certainly seeing quite a lot of now. Certainly people are coming in and saying that they've used sort of one of the more popular AI solutions. And the issues I think sometimes that we have is that there's perhaps more trust that's been placed in that AI answer than perhaps something that we as the GPs are going to come out with. And it's really important to understand that whilst absolutely, you know, online searches can be really helpful and certainly, you know, can help really help me with patients and really help patients, but also to recognise that there isn't a huge, they only have limited information from you. So what they're not perhaps seeing is, you know, your age, your sex, your demographics, your past history, the medications and things that you might be on. So there are nuances that aren't picked up by those AI technologies that I think sometimes can lead patients to a certain diagnosis that perhaps may cause more worry than actually is needed.
Although it's worth saying as well, isn't it? The diagnostic abilities of AI are pretty extraordinary. I mean, it's, you know, people used to Google their health concerns, didn't they? And that was a bit rough and ready. That there is an ability, and particularly actually if you feed in all those things that you've just mentioned, it is worth saying as well that people can be properly diagnosed by AI.
There are certainly AI triage tools that are in the development of making. I'm hoping that I'll still be within a job for the next few years at least.
That's a fair point, because they've still got to come to you eventually and you've got to undo what perhaps AI has taught them. Aldo Faisal, what's your view of what the BMJ open article brings us in the way of knowledge, proper usable knowledge, about the extent to which we are right to use these bots and the extent to which we're wrong?
Thank you for bringing me back on. So I think the challenge is that if you look at these AI systems, these chatbots that are out there, they're basically trained on information, on text that's out there on the internet. And I always say when we're talking about medical AI, and that's what we're doing at Imperial, we're one of the largest centers for development of medical AI in Europe, we are looking at the problem a bit like you have an English literature graduate who's very good at reading text and understanding text, and they read stuff about medicine or healthcare-related information on the internet, and then you start asking them questions, and you get answers of an English literature student. What we want to have is a system that answers and reasons like a medic. So they don't just regurgitate the text they've read. They have an understanding of how physiology, the body, anatomy, and disease mechanisms work. And out of that, they can compose an answer that makes sense.
That's interesting. So can they be better trained, is what you're saying?
They can be much better trained. And the trick is here not to think about chatbots as the answer engine that replaces your Google search, but to think about developing bespoke medical AI that is trained on medical data, not on Twitter or Shakespeare texts, but is trained on actual medical data. And that's precisely what we're doing at Imperial with the Nightingale AI Initiative. That's the goal, to harness this capability of making an AI that reasons like a medic and not like literature students.
So what are you feeding it then in terms of information? And crucially, I suppose, what are you withholding from it when it comes to the mass of stuff that there is, right, wrong, semi-right, semi-wrong, on the wider internet?
So first of all, by simply skipping text and by focusing on medical data, so this can be electronic medical records, this can be published results from clinical trials, it can be x-rays, it can be your electrocardiogram. This AI that we're developing is basically learning not to reason about text, but about very different modalities of information, images, blood work, your GP, clinical note, for example. And the system then puts this information together and then deduces from there what worked well for you, what didn't work well for you, and tries to find and come up systematically with better recommendations for you.
Sounds like you're in business at the moment, Dr. Harvey, but maybe not for that much longer.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, technology is coming on at such a rapid rate. And I think, you know, that it's really important that people understand that when they're using the current AI options that are there, they are trawling the internet and they're trawling everything that's on the internet. I've certainly heard lawyers talking the same about people getting legal advice, is that it's really important that you're looking at where that information is coming from and try and use a reliable resource with things. But ultimately, if you have a medical problem, then please do approach for medical care.
Dr. Harvey and Aldo Faisal as well. Thank you both.
It is coming up to 8:30. It's Cathy with the sport.
Morning. Thank you very much. Liverpool are out of the Champions League. Two goals from Ousmane Dembele gave Paris Saint-Germain a 2-0 victory on the night, a 4-0 win over the two legs of their quarter-final. We can speak to the former Liverpool and England goalkeeper. Morning, David James.
Good morning, Cathy.
I am interested in some of Arne Slot's comments after this match. He was quite upbeat and positive about their performance, saying things like, the future looks very bright for this team, for this club. We've shown we can compete with the champions of Europe in our stadium. Did he have reason to be so positive, given Liverpool were beaten 4-0 over those two legs?
I think he did, but I think it'd be very wrong of me not to remember, the 97 live lost at Hillsborough. It's a Remembrance Day today, and all those people who are still affected by that.
Yeah.
I I listened to his interview. I mean, it was, Carthy, I mean, it was a tough watch for Liverpool fans. So many moments which were potential game changers, tie changers. But what I did see was a very spirited performance by Liverpool. And I think Arna made the point that, you know, up against the best team in Europe, arguably in the world, even if they haven't got the trophy, Liverpool put in a very great effort. I think for what they need for the rest of the season, that was exactly what everyone wanted to see.
Yeah, spirit of performance is important. You know, they've knocked out of the Champions League now. That means Liverpool cannot win any silverware this season. They lifted the Premier League trophy around this time last year. They're currently in fifth place in the Premier League. What do you think then would be an acceptable season for the club?
Well, I think finishing in the Champions League positions, of course. I kind of look at it this way, Carthy. If you took the two seasons and added them together, Liverpool to finish in fifth place in the first season and win the Premier League this season, I think that would be acceptable. So to finish in fifth place, Champions League qualification, I think that's the acceptable level for Arna this season.
Yeah, and I know you're across everything in football at the moment, so it's a massive week for Arsenal. They have a 1-0 lead against Sporting in the Champions League, and they face their nearest rivals in the Premier League title race, Manchester City, on Sunday. Is tonight therefore about more than just reaching the semi-finals, and I say just knowing it's the Champions League?
Well, it's a tough one for Mikel Arteta, isn't it, and his Arsenal side, given that they were pushed, or they went so far and so close last season as well, if not previous seasons with the Premier League. Yeah, it depends where they're aiming for. If it's solely the Premier League, then this will be a welcome distraction, given that Man City is going to be tough. As you said on the weekend, if he goes for both, then will he miss out on both? That's a big question. But it's definitely going to be an interesting time for Arsenal supporters over the next week.
Yeah, it is indeed. Very important. David James, thank you very much for talking to me this morning. A few of the World Cup qualifier headlines from last night. England women beat world champion Spain 1-0 at Wembley. Wales women had a 4-0 win over Albania. Scotland scored a late equaliser to claim a 1-0 draw with Belgium. Northern Ireland beat Malta 4-0. And the three-time Olympic champion Adam Peaty won the 100-metre breaststroke at the British Swimming Championships in a time of 58.97 seconds to confirm his place on the British team for this summer's European Aquatics Championships. He's taken time out since the Paris Olympics, and that is now the second fastest time this year for the 100 metres. So pretty impressive.
Thank you for that, Carthy. Here now is Dr. Sean Williams with details of what is coming up at 9 this morning here on Radio 4.
Life-changing moments can be hard to define, but for many of us, they're the times when we hold our first child in our arms and we look at them and they look at us and we're probably both thinking, now what? On today's programme, we hear from Karin, who was adopted at birth and who asked a different question when she first locked eyes with her child. Who did this for me? Why did they decide to have me adopted? And what'll happen if I try to find them? The answers were not what she expected. Life-changing. After the news at 9.
Quick look at the weather now. Today is going to be unsettled and windy. A band of showery rain will move east through the UK, clearing to blustery showers with infrequent lightning in western areas. Drier by the evening.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4. Nick Robinson and Justin Webb. The time's just coming up to 25 to 9. Here's Alan Smith with the news.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, will meet the US Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent in Washington today. She said she's angry and frustrated that America has gone to war with Iran without an exit plan. The Chief Secretary to the Treasury, James Murray, told us it was not a war the UK had chosen to get involved in, but it had demonstrated the importance for the British government to promote energy independence and stick to its fiscal rules. The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency says there's been a very serious increase in North Korea's ability to produce nuclear weapons. Rafael Grossi said the activity had been intensifying at a key nuclear site, and it's likely Pyongyang would be capable of producing a few dozen warheads. A Labour MP has told us the government must crack down on law firms and advisers exposed in a BBC investigation for charging thousands of pounds to help migrants pretend to be gay to allow them to stay in the UK. Jo White, a member of the Home Affairs Select Committee, said she hoped the police would investigate. And the Competition and Markets Authority has fined two driving schools owned by the AA more than £4 million for what's known as drip pricing. The CMA said the firms had not included a mandatory £3 booking fee in their upfront prices.
Thank you for that. It is now 25 to 9. What's happened to American universities? Not all of them, but some, including some big names, seem to their critics to have given up on freedom of speech or even mildly controversial subjects. The students, aggressive and entitled, laying down the law. A new documentary examines the whole phenomenon of cancel culture, particularly on US campuses, which was first widely reported back in 2017 during the spring campus protests at the Evergreen State College. The then president, George Bridges, became a central figure in all of this when he complied with student demands to restrict his physical behaviour. So protesting students had surrounded him and demanded that he stopped using hand gestures while speaking.
Put your hand down.
That's my problem, George. You keep doing these little hand movements.
Moving hands in a situation like where you're already in the position of power.
Using your hands and sort of dismissing things.
That was a microaggression.
Can you watch your microaggression with your hands and your posture, please?
Yeah.
That's not appropriate. You gotta put your hands down. You know you gotta put your hands down.
I'm working on my hands.
The real point is power. We have the power to make the president of the college not use his hands when he talks.
That was a clip from the Storyville documentary. I'll tell you how you can see it in just a second. But let us hear first from Rick Esther Beanstock, who is the Emmy Award-winning filmmaker, who is the director and producer of the documentary. The documentary is called Speechless. I asked her why she wanted to make it.
I initially looked into the subject at around 2015, where I read an article about students starting to demand protection from words and looking for safe spaces on campus. And terms like microaggressions and safe spaces started coming up. Now they're very familiar terms to me, but at the time that was new, and that wasn't my experience when I went to university. Mm-hmm. And it troubled me as a parent and as a citizen that students didn't want to engage with ideas that offended them and were insulted by them, and sometimes to the point where students were scared to speak because they didn't know if something they said might be challenged. And that's what set me on. And my kids were university age, were starting to go to university, and I wanted to see what their world was going to be like.
Okay, so you went to that world, and what did you find?
Well, the first stop was suddenly there were students in this very progressive college in the United States called Evergreen State College live streaming a campus takeover. And it was because of a progressive biology professor's email about a certain day of absence they were having, where they were at, every year they would ask black students and students of color to leave the campus to show how vital they were to the community. This year they wanted to switch it up and ask white students to leave. And this one professor said, I don't think it's right for you to ask somebody to leave. We shouldn't be judging people by their skin color. This resulted in a huge protest that took over several days. And I just hopped on a plane to try and see what was happening, why was this happening, and there were a spate of other protests around the states, and that kind of set me on the path of exploring, is this really happening? Is it happening to the extent that people say it's happening? And I found that it was.
And not only that it was, but the degree of violence. You say protests, and that's how we think of these things, isn't it? But actually, it goes beyond protesting, doesn't it? It goes to interfering with the lives and the livelihoods of people that they disagree with.
I think I wouldn't say it's violence. I think if you think of words as violence, maybe. I just think there's been less and less of a tolerance for certain ideas that are considered controversial. And that was what troubled me more, because if you're scared to talk about things in a class, if a professor is fearful of losing his job because he doesn't have tenure, he or she, and decides to clean the syllabus because it's not worth potentially offending a student because they'll be investigated, then that has a really profound impact on education and how we're shaping the minds of these future leaders and citizens. For me, university was a place where I grappled with lots of different ideas, and I loved nothing more than arguing with friends and then going out and having a lunch. So the idea that people would be frightful of speaking on some, you know, with some kind of ideas that aren't that extreme. I'm not talking about hate speech. I'm not talking about free speech in the kind of First Amendment American way. I'm talking about our ability to speak freely about ideas and issues without fear of cancellation.
Yeah, and in a way that also potentially affects people's ability to do their jobs. It's not just the students, is it? There was an academic at Harvard, a woman called Carol Hooven. She lost her job at Harvard because she's an evolutionary biologist, and she said biological sex is real and there are two sexes and you can't change sex. She said it on a television program and lost her job. So the ability, in other words, of academics to function as academics, did you find that that is also widespread, that their ability is being hampered?
Carol Hooven features in Speechless in the film. And, you know, what I tried to do in the film was really not make judgment, but take you into these stories, show you how it happens. It happens with tweets and emails and ostracization. And yes, you're absolutely right. She had to leave. And there are many other professors like that. And there are hundreds of professors that we spoke to that were petrified to actually talk on the record, but acknowledged that they had to change their syllabus, or it just simply wasn't worth the risk of engaging in certain ideas. At the same time, it's not everywhere, and it's not in every university. And I just want to say that it's not only American. I'm in Canada, and it's here, and it's all over the UK as well. I'm sure you have stories. Free speech has become a real battle. And also, interestingly, I think of free speech as a universal value. And there was a period where free speech suddenly became a right-wing dog whistle in the States when I'd say I was doing a film about free speech on campus. And now, post-October 7th, it's back to being a left-wing value. But I say that with a smile on my face because it has to be a universal value. We have to be able to talk across differences and to speak our minds.
Rick Esther Beanstalk, thank you so much for talking to us. And just to say, both episodes of Story Revolves, so it's a story told in these two documentary episodes, both of them now available on the iPlayer.
It is 18 minutes to nine now, and it's 3 years today since Sudan's civil war erupted, triggered by a power struggle between the regular army and paramilitary fighters, the RSF, or Rapid Support Forces. The fighting has led to a de facto partition of the country and created the world's largest humanitarian crisis. The fall of the western city of El Fasher in October last year was one of the most brutal chapters of the conflict. Journalist Mohamed Suleiman was there, and remarkably, for almost all of that period, in the middle of a communications blackout that cut off his and other people's connection to the world outside. He's now made it to safety, and his account is a story about the worst of the war and the resilience of Sudan's people, as our Africa correspondent Barbara Pletusher now reports.
This sound is so familiar and so crucial to how we live our lives. But when Mohamed Suleiman entered the telecoms office in Port Sudan in January, he hadn't heard a phone ring for a very long time. He'd been isolated by conflict and unable to convey fully the horrors he was witnessing.
I was flustered because people were talking on their phones inside the office. Throughout the past 3 years, my phone has mostly been silent. After I inserted the SIM card, my tears flowed.
When his phone sprang to life, it was pinging with 3 years of messages, news of colleagues who died, friends asking whether Mohamed was alive.
A few days ago, a friend called me saying he thought I had died. Some people had told him that I was in Port Sudan, so he called me, but he didn't believe it until I called him back by video. Then he broke down in tears.
Mohamed had been trapped in the western city of El Fasher, an epicenter of the war. From the beginning, communications were very unstable because of the fighting. But that became a full blackout when the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces laid siege to the city. In some ways, the silence was almost as deadly as the violence. He felt suffocated as he watched people, including children, die of hunger, thirst, and disease. He was unable to call and warn others when he saw drones coming.
One
Once a shell narrowly missed him, but he lay still for half an hour, clutching his useless phone. And when the RSF finally took over the city in October last year, the relentless daily trauma exploded into apocalyptic scenes.
The scenes of displacement are indescribable. It was like the Day of Judgment on Earth. We witnessed the Day of Judgment on Earth. We saw dead children in the streets. We saw women crying from extreme hunger and thirst. And because they were too weak to carry their children, so they left them on the road. There were people we knew by name, and we knew their fathers, but we could not provide anything for them. There was no food, no water, no first aid to save them or to carry them with us. You cannot do anything. So you step over them, jump over them, cry, and continue walking.
Many fled the fighting to the nearest safe place, the town of Tawila. The road they took was littered with the dead and injured. If there'd been a way to call for help, says Mohammed, they wouldn't have had to leave so many wounded behind.
There are things I cannot describe because they are inhumane. I cannot talk about them. And unfortunately, the media did not convey the scene. Until now, the world does not know what happened in Al-Fashir City, nor does the state know.
Mohammed Suleiman is reconnected to the world. But he says, after what he's witnessed and experienced, it feels like the world has not returned to him.
There's no international law in the world. There's no such thing as the United Nations. If there are human rights international organizations, no day would pass in Al-Fashir with people dying, hungry and thirsty, bombed by shells and drones. There's no ceasefire, no medicine, no basic necessities of life. This confirms that there is no world to begin with.
And it's a different country. Sudan is fragmented, its peoples scattered. But, says Mohammed, telling their story helps him hold on to a sense of purpose.
There are events that happened that no one is left to narrate, and the memory remains only with us. Until we die, we will convey the truth to correct the situation for the next generation so they live dignified and honoured in their homeland.
That was Barbara Platt-Usher reporting on Sudan. It brings us to 12 minutes to 9.
Nicole Kidman has revealed her next role, and it's to be an end-of-life doula. This, though, is not on the stage or screen, but in real life. The actress says she's an intense desire to help others during their last few weeks on Earth, and she's now training to provide emotional, physical and psychological support to the dying. Well, let's talk about what a doula is and what a doula can do to help people, not just those who are dying, but those who care for people who are dying, with someone who does just that. Dr. Emma Clare is Chief Executive of End of Life Doula UK, and we're joined by Susan, who worked with and was helped by a death doula to support her husband before he died from Parkinson's disease. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Susan, good morning. First of all, were you like me, and I confess, I'd never heard the word death doula before. Did you know what it was?
I had no idea. And it was, I did know about a birth doula, and it was my daughter, actually, who saw me struggling and decided that we should try to get a doula. So this is how I had the best thing that ever happened to me at that stage.
Oh, well, that's quite a recommendation. Best because why, Susan?
Because I was struggling, my husband was struggling, and to have somebody who came into the house who understood my husband, who knew, who got him to talk about his life, he so looked forward to it. And I had half a day every week where I could go off and do whatever I wanted and be well aware that when I came back, he wouldn't have really missed me at all.
So a breather for you and a support for him. Was it also possible, perhaps they wouldn't have told you, but I'd be interested, that he could say things to someone other than his wife that maybe he was reluctant to say to you?
I don't think he was ever reluctant, but I think that he was foreign born. He was able to talk about his past, She brought out all the stories from him that he had in him, that actually, although we knew so much of it, you get over to a stage in life where you don't really listen anymore. And so for him, it was a whole new experience of being able to be back where he belonged.
It sounds like a wonderful recommendation. Well, let's turn to Dr. Claire now. You better define for us exactly what a doula is. It's clearly a listening ear. It's a help. But what in practice is it?
Yes, all of those things. So we provide non-medical support to people who are approaching the end of life, be that through having a terminal illness or just through older age. And we often describe our role as filling the gaps in people's existing support network. So our role is usually a mixture of emotional, practical and sometimes spiritual support if people are looking for that too.
And is this a paid-for service or a voluntary service?
It varies. That's up to the individual doula. We, as a membership association, we support our members to charge if they want to. And one of the important things to say around that is that we don't want that to be a barrier to people accessing support. So as a charity, we fundraise so that we can subsidise if people otherwise couldn't afford a doula.
And being a listening ear is something that any good volunteer could do with a little bit of training. But is there also expert knowledge about what someone who is facing the end of their life is facing?
Yeah, I think we don't say expert knowledge because we really believe this is knowledge that everybody should have. We've become quite disconnected from death and dying, and it's knowledge that everyday people in communities used to have that's been lost. But definitely you can imagine working alongside our health and social care system, which can be very tricky to navigate, even if you're familiar with it. We need expert knowledge in that sense of knowing what other services do, how to navigate them, who to go to for different things.
You can be an advocate as well as a listening ear.
Very much so. I think forming that relationship over time, we often work with a whole family unit over many months, sometimes years. Getting to know what matters most to that person, their priorities, so we can advocate for them is one of the main parts of our role.
Let me just end by giving Susan the last word. Susan, to have a stranger come into your house at such an emotionally sensitive time would be quite alarming to some people. Why did you feel that you could overcome that anxiety that you might have had about a total stranger coming in?
I really didn't have any anxiety. It was such a relief that somebody was going to come in and give me and him the support and information on everything that I needed to go forward in these circumstances. It was not a problem, and I wish that so many people would be able to understand that a doula is out there and the help that it will help everything in their life.
We should, Susan, given the recommendation you've given, give people a chance to get hold of more information on this. Doula, spelt by, incidentally, D-O-U-L-A, if you're searching for it online. And Dr. Claire, just tell us, if someone wants to find someone in their area, what should they do?
We have a contact form on our website. If you complete that, we will get back to you promptly, or you can call the number on our website.
Dr. Emma Clare of End of Life Doula UK, that's the name of the website you'd be looking for, and Susan, whose husband died of Parkinson's disease, but obviously got great comfort and support from her End of Life Doula. Thank you both very much indeed.
7 minutes to 9 is the time.
Now, if you listen to people from Lancashire, you'll know that that's how they say it. There's an R, a long R, which gives it a kind of burr. But apparently, it's disappearing. Just to remind you what it ought to sound like, listen to the famous Lancastrian, the Speaker of the House of Commons, Lindsay Hoyle, talking about what he would like to have on his coat of arms.
I'm told that I'm the first ever Lancastrian speaker, so we're going to make the most of this. And of course, if I was to do that, I would want a Lancashire rose. That's what it's all about. It's about Lancashire, making the voice of Lancashire here in London. And I think if I do have that, it's got to have the centre with the Lancashire rose.
I don't think he quite gave the full R, but the woman who really knows is fellow Lancastrian actor, best known perhaps for her role in Absolutely Fabulous, Jane Horrocks joins us. Morning, Jane.
Good morning.
Give us a few Lancastrian burrs, will you? Show us what it ought to sound like.
Good morning.
It's the long, drawn-out, rolling R. Is that what it is?
Yes, it is, yes. But I think that it's only specific to certain parts of Lancashire. I don't think all Lancashire towns have it.
So where's got it and where hasn't?
Well, strangely, I mean, they have it in Rawtenstall, which is where I'm from, and they have it in Blackburn.
Yes.
But
as soon as you say that, I think immediately people in Blackburn.
Yeah. But I'm not sure that Burnley, which is in between Blackburn and Rawtenstall, has it so much. So, I mean, that's what's so interesting about the Lancashire accent. Within like a 5-mile radius, the accent changes slightly. There's variations to each accent.
But when you hear that R, does it make you feel at home?
Yes, it does. Yeah, when I hear people in London speaking with that R, I'll just go, hello, hello, from the same place.
Yeah. And what about when you were a kid? Because, of course, there's dialect as well as the accent. There's a Lancashire dialect too. Were you brought up speaking it in that way?
Oh, no. No, that had died a long time ago. My grandpa used to speak with the dialect, but he died when I was very little, so I never really knew him. But, yeah, I mean, it's sort of like the Lancashire patois.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to understand. But, well, yeah, that's long gone.
Well, Jane apparently is in trouble. We're joined by Professor Claire Nance here, Professor of Phonetics at Lancaster University, of course, in Lancashire, who can tell us why. You've noticed that this Lancashire burr, the R's, are beginning to die out, have you, Professor Nance?
Yes, yes. And we've been doing some research in Blackburn and Burnley and also in Preston, Lancaster and Barrow. And nowadays it's really just confined to Blackburn and Burnley, kind of East Lancashire area.
Mm-hmm.
But we did find in the past it was pronounced in places like Preston and maybe some older people in Lancaster and Preston areas. But it's kind
of disappearing. Why do you think it's dying out? Is it the same reason that many accents are dying out, which is people are learning their languages even as little children from what they watch on a screen and not what from they hear in their house or down the road?
Well, there's that, but people move around, don't they? So we've been looking at population movement during the Industrial Revolution and how people came from all over the place to work in industries in Lancashire. And we found in places like Preston, people moved locally, but in places like Barrow and Lancaster, people were coming from a bit further away. So you get more sort of population mixing and new dialects coming out of that mix.
Do you think it's connected, at least in people's minds, with what Lancashire was and partly the industries that made those Lancashire mill towns as prosperous as they once were, but rather sadly are not now?
Well, I think there's still a very strong sense of identity and strong sense of community. And you get that retained in places like Blackburn and Burnley and East Lancashire. And that's kind of associated with those industries. Yes. So I think people do retain some of that industrial pride, definitely.
Turning back to you, Jane, was it ever a problem for you having that accent? Was there pressure on you to speak proper, in inverted commas?
Well, I went to RADA and they did try and encourage me to mellow my accent. And believe it or not, it is quite mellowed from what it used to be. And when I talk to my brother, who lives in Burnley, his accent is still really strong.
There's people like me listening just saying, I hope she says Burnley again, because that's where you hear it most.
I mean, it's been my calling card, really. I mean, it's my identity. Whenever I've tried to, well, I went to elocution lessons when I was, in my early teens, and my friends just couldn't tolerate me being posh. Also, I just completely lost my personality when I lost my accent, so it is me.
You had to go back to it. Now, did they get you to do some sort of voice exercises like Eliza Doolittle at RADA to try and get rid of the accent?
No.
No.
No,
luckily
definitely not.
Yeah. But let's hear it for the Lancashire R. You'd like it to survive, I assume, Jane?
Yes, I would like it to survive. I think it's a really unusual thing. I mean, it's interesting when other actors try to do it or are not from the area, they usually sound like they're from Cornwall because the placement of the R is so far back in the